Tales of Tom 2.0 Book 1. Colorado Tom and the Pillar of Deceit. Everyone has a little Indiana Jones in them. Here is my tale. It is January 1965, and I am in the Army, feeling a mixture of excitement and apprehension as I navigate this new chapter of my life. I have just settled in with my three new roommates at Merrill Barracks in Nuremberg, Germany, each of whom brings their own unique personality and stories that make the barracks feel more like a home. The walls are bare with an ugly green at the bottom up to the waist and dull yellow up to the ceiling, one large overhead light in the center of the ceiling. Four beds and four wall lockers filled the room. Each evening, as we gather in the common area, we share tales of our lives before the Army, forging bonds that I hope will last a lifetime. The crisp winter air outside reminds me of the challenges ahead, but the warmth of friendship within these walls makes me feel ready to face anything that comes my way. Bob, a short, stocky young man in his 20s hailing from the bustling streets of Chicago, often spoke fondly of the Windy City and its vibrant culture. Angelo, a tall, slim individual, brought a different kind of energy from the lush landscapes of Upper New York, always sharing stories of the serene lakes and mountains where he spent his weekends hiking. George, the youngest among us, was both tall and broad, with deep family roots stretching back to the sunny West Coast in Pasadena, California, where he reminisced about the laid-back lifestyle and beach outings with his close-knit family. We were all new replacements for troops rotating out of the 2nd Armored Cavalry Regiment, a unit tasked with the critical mission of safeguarding the German border from the looming Soviet threat, which was situated just across the line in communist Czechoslovakia. Headquarters Company and Aviation Company were effectively stationed in Nuremberg, a city rich in history, while three combat battalions were strategically positioned along the border of Germany and Czechoslovakia. The four of us, each with our unique backgrounds and stories, were assigned to the aviation company, ready to contribute our skills and camaraderie to this essential mission in a time of heightened tensions. Nuremberg, Germany, holds a significant and somber chapter in history, deeply intertwined with Nazi and Hitler's legacy. The area known as the Nazi Party Rally Grounds is a haunting reminder of the events that unfolded during that dark period. One prominent location within this area is Merrill Barracks, a site that served as a barracks for some of Hitler's SS troops, infamous for their unyielding loyalty to his regime. This was the residence of some of Hitler's most ruthless operatives, whose actions are still scrutinized and condemned today. The front of the building bears the scars of history, pockmarked with bullet fire from the Second World War, a stark visual testament to the violence that once erupted around it. Now, the four of us occupy a room within this institution that may have previously housed men devoid of conscience, a chilling thought that lingers in the air. If only the walls could talk, they would surely recount stories of both oppression and ideology that permeated every corner. The living quarters were situated at the front of the compound, while the back housed the equipment area designed for tactical vehicles such as tanks, trucks, and trailers, essential for the military operations that took place. Surrounding the entire compound was a 10-foot-high barbed wire fence, designed not only to contain but to intimidate, reflecting the high security that was enforced. This tight measure was in place because, in the depths of the basement, tactical nuclear weapons were stored, adding yet another layer of horror to this already grim location. The juxtaposition of historical significance and present-day life within these walls creates an eerie atmosphere that serves as a constant reminder of the past. Another place was Soldiers Field. It may be called something else by other people, but military personnel referred to it as Soldiers Field, a name that resonates with pride and remembrance. This historic site often served as a venue for army parades, showcasing the discipline and strength of the troops. It bears a striking resemblance to the iconic football field where the Chicago Bears play, a testament to its grand design and purpose. If you ever saw old news clips featuring Hitler, you would recognize this as the location where many of his notorious rallies were held, a stark reminder of a turbulent past. Nearby stood Congress Hall, which resembled the grandeur of Rome's Colosseum, its majestic architecture echoing tales of ancient glory. Not too far away was the airfield, a crucial site in military history. Though I can't recall having a specific name for it, we simply called it the airfield. This was the dedicated airfield for the 2nd Armored Cavalry Regiment, a critical component of the military's operations during its time. Surrounding the airfield were impressive pillars, meticulously built, and according to some accounts, these pillars were intended to support a massive roof that would ultimately cover the airfield, creating a sheltered space for various activities. However, Hitler's ambitious vision for this grand structure never came to fruition, leaving only the pillars as a silent witness to what could have been. In the first couple of months, you learn about your new surroundings, and each passing day brings a fresh wave of experiences that deepen your understanding of this foreign land. This was a new experience for my other three roommates and me, who were each navigating our feelings of homesickness and the excitement of uncertainty. All of us were drafted into the army, and now we were 5,000 miles away from home in a foreign country, grappling with the realization that our lives had irrevocably changed. You learn many things, from the simplest tasks to the more complex navigations of military life. You find out where the mess hall and the PX is, where routines quickly become second nature, and familiarity breeds a sense of comfort amidst the chaos. You learn about the intricate routine in your new unit, from early morning formations to late night drills, which create a camaraderie that bonds us in shared trials and laughter. In addition to all of the normal activities and directions, you also start to hear about all the rumors and stories regarding the interesting history behind the buildings and the location you are currently living in. Whispers of the past echo through the halls, and we hear the story that the Nazis had all these buildings and locations connected with elaborate underground tunnels, that mysterious and sprawling networks wove beneath our feet. These tunnels supposedly hid large caverns filled with all kinds of military equipment, such as planes, tanks, and other military items that remained buried from prying eyes. When the Allies came near, it is rumored that the Nazis flooded the caverns, their precious equipment swallowed by the depths of betrayal and desperation. In one of our orientation meetings, we are informed that some areas could still be dangerous and off-limits because they may be booby-trapped, a grim reminder of the conflicts that once raged here. Exploring is not allowed, and the boundaries placed around us evoke a mixture of intrigue and caution. Are the rumors true? What secrets lie buried just below the surface, waiting for someone brave enough to uncover them? Now that I have set the stage, I will start with the adventure. The weather in Nuremberg was not very exciting while I was there. It was mostly overcast, cloudy, and drizzled a lot, with only fleeting moments of sunlight that seemed to tease the locals and tourists alike. When you did have a nice day, it was a day to remember, cherished like a rare gem amidst the usual gloom. One of these unforgettable days happened on a Sunday in August, a day that beckoned us to venture out and soak in the warmth of the sun. Also, it was a Sunday, and we had the day off, granting us the perfect opportunity to explore the city with a sense of adventure and freedom. After a leisurely lunch filled with laughter and shared stories, the four of us decided to make our way to the park, eager to delight in the beautiful weather. Around Soldiers Field, Congress Hall, and the airfield, there were park-like areas where the German population would come and bring their families, engaging in joyous picnics and taking leisurely strolls in the afternoon. The sounds of children's laughter and the aroma of various street foods filled the air, creating an inviting atmosphere. Also, on one corner there was a large outside beer garden that was very popular, bustling with locals enjoying their drinks and the sunshine. Anyway, we were roaming around in the park area, soaking in the vibrant energy of the crowd, when we ended up in the airfield area. The pillars I mentioned before were in the park area next to the airfield, standing tall and majestic against the clear blue sky. We knew there were steps on the inside of the pillars that allowed you to ascend and explore their heights. Each pillar contained three floors, and as we climbed higher, the excitement built within us for what lay ahead. The view from the top floor was nothing short of breathtaking, offering a panorama of the lush landscape and the distant horizon, where the sun dipped low, casting a warm glow over the surrounding area. We decided to embark on this little adventure to the top of the pillars, eager to enjoy the stunning vista on a sunny day since every other time we had visited, it had been cloudy or overcast, obscuring the beauty that we now anticipated experiencing fully. As we reached the pinnacle, the gentle breeze welcomed us, enhancing our sense of freedom and connection with nature. We went inside the pillar and walked up the stairs to the top floor. The floor was dusty and dirty from an accumulation of dust over many years, almost as if it had been forgotten by time itself. It was a nice view from the top floor, offering a glimpse of the expansive landscape below. When the sky was clear, you could see much farther than in an overcast sky, the horizon stretching endlessly and revealing rolling hills and distant trees. George and Bob started to mess around, their playful banter echoing off the empty walls. George was larger than Bob and he liked to use his definite advantage, often relishing in the opportunity to assert his physicality. George started to push Bob, who was laughing yet resisting the playful shove. However, as George was pushing Bob, his feet were sliding on the floor, causing him to lose his footing slightly. This sliding pushed away the accumulation of dust on the floor, revealing patches of the aged concrete beneath. I happened to look down at the floor where the dust was pushed aside and said, "What is this?" You could see where there was a straight separation on the floor, a sign that something lay hidden beneath. We started scraping away some more of the dust accumulation and it appeared to be some kind of lid or door, intriguing in its mystery. After a few minutes of moving the dust, we uncovered a definite square in the floor about 3 feet across, starkly contrasting with the surrounding remnants of dirt and grime. You could see that this section was definitely different from the other part of the floor. It was positioned in one of the corners of the pillars as if it were waiting to be discovered. What did we find? Was this a way to get into the tunnels and caverns below? The thought thrilled us, filling our minds with possibilities. We had to find a way to try to raise that lid or door. There was an accumulation of scrap metal on the outside perimeter of the pillar, which hinted at previous adventurers or builders who might have used this space. We all rushed down, looking for some kind of tool to pry that lid or door. Angelo, with his quick eye, found a piece of flat iron about 2 feet long and maybe a quarter inch thick, its edges sharp and glinting in the faint light. I found a couple of pieces that looked like rebar, sturdy and resilient. Rushing back up to the top floor, we assessed the situation and looked for a place to insert the flat iron between the floor and the lid, hoping for a precision fit that would yield results. However, we encountered disappointment as we could not find any place to accept the piece of quarter inch flat iron. We realized that we would need to break some of the concrete floor away from the separation so that the flat iron could finally be inserted. The rebar was used like a small spear, breaking the rock away with painstaking precision. After about 45 minutes of intense chipping away, with our muscles aching and the edge of excitement pushing us forward, the flat iron was finally able to fit into the opening between the floor and the lid. We did it. Slowly, with bated breath, the lid was raised. You could feel a draft of cool, moist air coming out of the opening, hinting at what lay below. We placed the rebar on opposite corners, cautiously raising the lid about an inch above the floor, just enough to slide our fingers underneath. With a final push, we raised the lid and propped it against the outside wall. The lid was a piece of maybe quarter inch steel, cleverly adorned with a concrete veneer on top to blend seamlessly into the concrete floor. What did we discover? Was it merely a passage, or was it a gateway to secrets long buried beneath the surface, waiting for explorers brave enough to delve into the unknown? We looked down the dark shaft and could feel a cool moist draft flowing from the shaft, as if the very breath of the earth was beckoning us closer. On two sides of the shaft were metal ladder rungs embedded into the rock walls, their surface rough and uneven, hinting at years of neglect and decay. The same material as the rebar we found outside of the pillar, suggesting a connection between this dark abyss and the world above. The rungs were very rusted and moist from the humid air, a testament to the dampness that enveloped the entire area. All of us smoked, and we all carried the famous Zippo lighter, smooth, reliable, and filled with nostalgia. We all lit our lighters and tried to view farther down the shaft, their flickering flames illuminating the way for mere moments, teasing us with shadows that danced along the walls. We could only see about 6 or 8 feet farther and could not see much. It felt as if the darkness swallowed the light, taunting our eager eyes. All we could see was the rungs of the metal ladder going down the two walls, leading into an unknown abyss that stirred both excitement and fear within us. We can't stop now. Our curiosity was overriding our common sense, igniting a fire in our minds that demanded to be satiated. We have to go get some flashlights and gloves so we can enter that shaft of deceit, ready to uncover whatever lay hidden in the depths below. Who would have ever thought you would have to go to the top of a pillar to find a shaft that may lead to the tunnels and caverns below? The very idea thrilled us, though it also sent shivers down our spines as we considered what secrets and dangers might be lurking just out of sight. We replaced the lid and rushed back to Merrill Barracks to get equipment, our hearts pounding with anticipation and urgency. The barracks was about 2 miles away, and every step felt like an eternity as we navigated the familiar path in a race against time. The dimming sunlight cast long shadows, and an eerie sense of thrill filled the air. Once inside, we quickly gathered our flashlights, extra batteries, and thick, insulated gloves, each item a crucial component for the adventure that lay ahead. Wait a minute. We are going to an unknown place that could potentially lead us into disorientation, especially if we encounter multiple tunnels branching off in different directions. To counter this, Angelo suggested a roll of communication wire, a lightweight yet durable wire that comes on a generous 2,000-foot spool. This wire could be securely tied at the entrance of the shaft, allowing us to unwind it progressively as we bravely delved deeper into the unknown. Without wasting another moment, Angelo hurried to his radio truck and swiftly picked up the wire, his urgency mirroring the growing tension we all felt. The sun was sinking lower in the sky, and we knew that time was not on our side. All soldiers must be in the barracks by 8 p.m. on Sunday nights, and with the clock reading 5 o'clock already, the pressure mounted. We hastily retraced our steps back to the pillar, adrenaline coursing through our veins, and raised the heavy lid once more. What mysteries and dangers would await us down there? The anticipation was electric, and we were ready to confront whatever lay ahead. We start descending the shaft, the air growing cooler as we move deeper into the darkness. George and Bob go first, their silhouettes barely visible in the flickering beam of the flashlight. Angelo and I follow about 8 feet after them, each step echoing in the silent void. The rungs are much rusted, their integrity questionable, and a nervous thought crosses my mind, hopefully none will give way under the weight of a body. We go down, it seems like forever before we reach the floor, the descent feeling both thrilling and terrifying. Finally, we reach the bottom of the shaft, panting slightly from the effort. Looking up, you can see the communication wire dangling down like a lifeline. The opening looked like maybe 150 feet up from the floor of the shaft, a reminder of how far we've come. You could see that the sun is starting to set, casting eerie shadows that flicker against the walls of this hidden chamber. This is exciting. We are standing in a circular room about 25 feet in diameter, with ceilings about 12 feet high, the stout walls feeling like they are closing in around us. It is very dark, the dark walls absorb the beam from the flashlight, and you cannot see very far ahead, making every new shadow seem ominous. You can hear water dripping from the ceilings, creating a rhythmic plink that amplifies the eerie atmosphere, and the floors are wet and slippery, making each step a cautious adventure. In the background, you see rats scrambling to get away, their tiny claws making a scuttling noise against the stone. Some of them looked as big as beavers, their bulging eyes reflecting the flashlight's glow. I never saw rats that big. A shiver runs down my spine. I hate rats. Is this such a good idea? The thrill of exploration wrestles with a growing sense of dread as the reality of our surroundings sinks in. First decision, there are 3 tunnels. Which one do we take? After a brief discussion, we decide on the middle one, feeling an inexplicable pull toward its mysterious depths. The tunnel has a slight downward slope, and you can see that it is going down, creating an anticipation that quickens our hearts. We travel maybe 500 feet, the air becoming cooler and more humid with each step, until we encounter this large cavern that stretches far beyond our initial sight. Unfortunately, the cavern is full of water, its surface so still that it mirrors the jagged walls around us. The lights from the flashlights reflect off the water, creating an ethereal glow that dances across the cavern's ceiling, and you can see the tips of the tails of airplanes above the water, their metallic bodies eerily protruding from the depths, while the rest of the plane remains submerged in the abyss. The sight is haunting, especially since you can clearly discern the swastikas on the tails, symbols of a dark past that sends a chill down our spines. We exchange uneasy glances, aware that the weight of history surrounds us. Realizing we aren't equipped to go any further and knowing the potential dangers that lurk beneath the water's surface, we reluctantly backtrack to the circular room, our minds racing with unanswered questions and the chilling echoes of what we have just discovered. This time we take the tunnel on the left. It appears to be heading in the direction of Merrill Barracks, where whispers of secrets and untold stories linger in the air. We are running out of time. It is already 6:45, and we must be back in the barracks by 8 o'clock or risk serious consequences. With each step we take further into the tunnel, the atmosphere becomes thicker, more tense, as if the walls themselves hold memories of the past. We embark down this narrow passage and maybe go 1,000 feet, the dampness of the air clinging to our skin. There are all kinds of Nazi or German markings on the walls, remnants of a time long gone, evoking a sense of eerie nostalgia. Suddenly, we encounter a room built off the tunnel with a heavy steel door and a robust padlock, seemingly untouched by time. It looks like some kind of cell, a chilling discovery that sends shivers down our spines. A small, grimy window with rusted bars slightly frames the somber scene within. Shining the flashlight through the window, we see a cot and lying on the floor is a body dressed in a German soldier uniform, lifeless and forgotten. I guess they forgot that he was there, left behind in the shadows of history. This is getting interesting yet haunting. Time is running out, though, like sand slipping through an hourglass. George's flashlight has died, and others are getting dim, casting darker shadows around us as we realize the urgency of our situation. We have to be back in the barracks by 8 p.m., and we are going to need more wire to continue our exploration, since we only have about 500 feet of wire left, an alarming fact considering our ambitions. We rush back to the shaft and climb the ladder with a sense of urgency, adrenaline propelling us forward. We hastily replace the lid and rush back to the barracks, breathless and on edge, our hearts racing with the thrill of discovery. We make it just in time, thankful for the narrow margins we navigated today. When can we get back to this adventure? For the next 5.5 days, we have to play army, which means our time for exploration is limited, and it is hard to get off post during the week. The plan is to go back Saturday afternoon after duty, when the sun starts to dip low in the sky, casting golden hues across the horizon, igniting our imaginations with dreams of what lies ahead. As we count down the hours, the thrill of discovery runs through our veins, reminding us of the excitement that awaits us. Just thinking about the secrets we've uncovered fills us with a giddy sense of purpose, and we can't help but share knowing glances, each one reinforcing our resolve as the clock ticks by slowly. Secrecy is a must, no one can hear about our find, as the last thing we want is for others to get involved or to ruin the thrill of this secret journey we've embarked on. The anticipation builds with each passing day, fueling our eagerness to return to the hidden gem we've uncovered. Every moment spent waiting only heightening our desire to delve deeper into the mysteries that await us. We've begun to imagine the stories we will tell of our discoveries, the places we will explore, and the challenges we might face, each one only adding to the excitement of the great adventure that is just around the corner. Tuesday morning, the four of us are called into the orderly room, anxiety thickening the air as we file in, each of us sensing the gravity of the moment. The somber first sergeant, with his stern expression and weary eyes, informs us that all four of us have received orders to ship out this Friday, a sudden twist in our lives we could hardly have anticipated. Angelo and I are to go to Darmstadt, a place neither of us knows well but have heard whispered tales about. George is set to go to Berlin, a city rich with history and layers of its own mysteries, while Bob is to report to Bamberg, a place filled with its unique charms and an unknown fate. We ask the first sergeant what the deal was, a mix of curiosity and dread evident in our voices, and he simply shrugs, his frustration palpable as he mutters that he didn't know. All he said was that the orders came from 7th Army Headquarters, as though that offered any sort of clarity or relief. We never got to go back to the Pillar of Deceit, a place that haunts our memories, its shadow looming over us like a ghost waiting to be revisited. It has been 60 years since that abrupt change, and I often find myself wondering, are those pillars still there, standing as monuments to secrets long buried? Did anyone else ever stumble upon that enigmatic shaft hidden within the pillar, a gateway to truths we only glimpsed? Were those tunnels and caverns ever discovered, unearthing the tales of old? If you believe this story, I have a bridge for sale in Arizona. A solid reminder of how life's twists can often feel just as elusive and surreal as the mysteries we left behind. This bridge stands not just as a structure, but as a metaphor for the journeys we undertake, each step resonating with tales of joy and sorrow, bridges crossed and paths untaken. It embodies the hope that even amidst uncertainty, we can connect our past to our future, forging bonds that transcend time. The surrounding desert, with its stark beauty, whispers secrets of those who wandered before us, urging us to reflect on our own lives and the roads we've traveled. Dream or real? Lila woke to the sound of rustling leaves, her breath fogging in the crisp morning air. She blinked, and the world shimmered. Golden oaks and crimson maples stretched endlessly before her, their branches swaying in a breeze that smelled of earth and cider. She was in the forest again, the one she'd walked through last night. Or was it last week? Her fingers brushed the rough bark of a tree, solid and real, and she smiled, feeling the familiar connection to nature that always brought her peace. Sunlight filtered through the vibrant canopy, dappling the ground with patches of warmth that felt inviting against the coolness of the morning. A small bird chirped cheerfully in the distance, and she paused to listen, allowing the harmonious sounds of the forest to envelop her like a cozy blanket. Fall had arrived, her favorite season, painting the world in hues that felt like home, where every rustling leaf and fluttering wing told a story of transformation and comfort, as if inviting her to discover the secrets hidden within this enchanting landscape. She wandered deeper, the crunch of leaves underfoot a steady rhythm that accompanied her thoughts like a familiar song. A deer darted past, its antlers catching the low sunlight, and she laughed. Hadn't she fed it apples yesterday? Or had that been a dream? The thought slipped away as she reached a clearing where a wooden bench sat, weathered but familiar, a silent witness to the passage of time and countless fleeting moments. She settled onto it, pulling her sweater tight against the chill that seemed to seep through the air, and watched the sky shift from amber to violet, painting a masterpiece that only nature could create. A gentle breeze rustled the branches above, carrying with it the scent of pine and damp earth, while distant birds sang their evening songs. Time didn't matter here, it was just her and the season, entwined in a tranquil embrace that felt both timeless and fleeting. "Lila," a voice called, soft but insistent. She turned, but no one was there, only the wind, whispering through the branches, carrying with it a symphony of rustling leaves that seemed to echo her confusion. She frowned. That voice, it had been in her room this morning, hadn't it? The memory lingered in her mind like a haunting melody, before the leaves. Before the forest. Her head ached, and the scene flickered before her eyes, blurring reality with a dreamlike haze. Suddenly, the trees were bare, then budding pink blossoms unfurling like delicate fans, the air warming with the sweet scent of rain and new grass. Spring now, not fall. The world transformed, vibrant colors awakening all around her. She stood, confused, as petals drifted around her like snowflakes caught in a gentle breeze, each one a reminder of the fleeting passage of time. The bench was gone, replaced by a patch of wildflowers that danced joyfully in the wind. Hadn't she planted those? Doubt crept in as she examined the landscape, the familiar now tinged with surreal beauty, blurring the lines between her memories and the enchanting present. She knelt, touching the soft petals, and memories, or dreams, rushed in like a tide pulling her under. She'd danced here under a pastel sky, her hands stained with soil as she whirled freely, feeling the warmth of the sun on her face and the whisper of leaves in the gentle breeze. Or had she watched it from her window, longing to join the magic outside? The forest blurred, and suddenly, she was in her bedroom, staring at a cracked ceiling that seemed to close in on her as the moments faded. A woman leaned over her, her face lined with worry, shadows playing across her features as if reflecting the depth of her concern. "Lila, you're awake. You were talking about leaves again," the woman said softly, her voice the one from the wind, but sharper now, tethering her spirit to the present. It was a voice that carried the weight of love and grounding, pulling Lila back to reality, bringing forth a sense of safety amidst the swirling chaos of her thoughts. Lila blinked, trying to shake off the lingering fog in her mind. The room smelled stale, not like rain or earth, but rather like an unforgiving emptiness that gnawed at her senses. A tray of pills sat on the nightstand, each one a bright reminder of her reality, and a calendar read March 21, 2025. Spring, she thought wistfully, but where were the blossoms? The vibrant colors and lively scents that usually filled the air seemed painfully absent. She looked down at her hands, clean, glaringly so, devoid of any trace of soil or the sticky sweetness of apple juice from feeding the deer with her own hands. "I was there," she murmured softly to herself, feeling a deep yearning wash over her. The forest. It's fall there now. Or spring. "I can't," her voice trailed off, swallowed by the silence of the room, and the woman sighed, feeling a profound disconnect between the vivid memories of her time in the forest and the dull, clinical environment surrounding her now. The weight of absence settled heavily upon her chest, making it hard to breathe as she longed for the embrace of nature's cycle, for the chirping of birds and the rustling of leaves, simple pleasures that now felt like distant echoes. "You've been here all night," the woman said gently, her voice soothing like a soft breeze. "Dreaming again, just as you often do. The doctor says it's getting harder for you to come back, as if each journey to that other realm pulls you further away from us. I can see the worry etched on your face even in your slumber, the way your brow furrows and your lips part slightly, as though you're lost in something profoundly beautiful yet terrifying. I wish I could follow you into those dreams, to understand what captivates you so deeply and to bring you back safely when the time comes." Lila shook her head, her mind racing with disbelief. "No, I walked there. I felt it." She closed her eyes tightly, and the room around her dissolved into a haze of color and light. Suddenly, she found herself back in the forest, where leaves were falling in slow spirals, the golden hues painting a serene picture of autumn. With each leaf that touched the ground, she felt seasons transform like a carousel spinning endlessly in the sky. The gentle rustle of branches accompanied the soothing sounds of nature, as the deer returned, their soft noses nudging her hand. Lila laughed, the sound bursting forth like music, and tears streaked her face, a blend of joy and nostalgia overwhelming her senses. "This is real," she whispered breathlessly into the crisp air, though the woman's voice echoed faintly in the background, calling her name with urgency, as if trying to tether her to the present even as she reveled in the beauty of the moment. Days passed or didn't. Lila roamed her forest, seasons blending into a tapestry she couldn't untangle. Fall's golden decay gave way to spring's tender green, then back again, a loop of beauty she couldn't escape. Each step brought the rustle of leaves beneath her feet and the whispers of the wind, wrapping around her like a familiar embrace. Sometimes she heard the woman, saw the room, felt the pills pressed to her lips, the cold, clinical atmosphere of the space stifling her spirit. But the forest always reclaimed her, pulling her back into its embrace, its colors brighter than the gray walls surrounding her, its air sweeter than the sterile tang of reality, infusing her with a sense of freedom she thought she had lost forever. The vibrant hues of wildflowers danced along the path, and the melody of birdsong filled her ears, a reminder that life thrived beyond the confines of her mind. One evening or morning she sat on the bench again, watching the sky burn orange, then soften to pink, painting a canvas of warmth that enveloped her. The voice called, fainter now, and she didn't turn, for she was lost in the beauty surrounding her. "I'll stay," she said to the deer, to the trees, to the seasons that held her gently in their embrace. "This is where I belong." The forest hummed in agreement, a symphony of rustling leaves and distant bird calls, and Lila let go, sinking into a world where dreams and reality were one, forever spring, forever fall, where the colors danced vibrantly in the air, wrapping her in a tapestry woven from the very essence of nature. She felt the soft touch of the breeze as it whispered secrets of the earth, and in that moment, she knew she was a part of something greater, something eternal. House on a Hill. The old house on the hill had stood empty for decades, its windows dark and its walls weathered by time. Clara had passed it every day on her way to town, always wondering about the stories it held. One crisp autumn evening, as the sun dipped low, she noticed something different, a faint flicker of light in the upstairs window. Curiosity tugged at her, and against her better judgment, she decided to investigate. The front door creaked open with surprising ease, as if it had been waiting for her. Inside, the air was thick with dust, and the faint scent of lavender lingered. Clara's footsteps echoed on the warped wooden floor as she climbed the stairs, drawn to the room where she'd seen the light. The door at the top was ajar, and a soft glow spilled out. In the room sat a woman, her back to Clara, hunched over a small table. She wore a faded dress, its hem frayed, and her silver hair cascaded down her back. A single candle burned before her, casting long shadows across the walls. Clara hesitated, then cleared her throat. The woman didn't turn. "I've been expecting you," she said, her voice low and steady. Clara froze. "Expecting me? I don't even know you." "You don't need to," the woman replied. "You're here for the truth, aren't you?" Clara's heart thudded. She hadn't told anyone she was coming, hadn't even known herself until moments ago. "What truth?" she asked, stepping closer. The woman gestured to a chair across the table. "Sit. I'll show you." On the table lay a small wooden box, intricately carved with swirling patterns. The woman slid it toward Clara. "Open it," she said. Hands trembling, Clara lifted the lid. Inside was a photograph, yellowed with age. It showed a young girl, no more than 5, with wide eyes and a shy smile, standing in front of this very house. A man and woman stood beside her, their faces blurred by time. Clara frowned. "Who is this?" The woman finally turned, her face illuminated by the candlelight. Her eyes were sharp, piercing, and oddly familiar. "Look closer," she said. Clara studied the photo again, then gasped. The girl's dress, the same faded fabric, the same frayed hem matched the one the woman wore now. "That's you," she stammered. The woman nodded. "I've waited a long time for you to come back." "Come back?" Clara's mind raced. "I've never been here before." The woman smiled faintly, a sad curve to her lips. "You have. You just don't remember." Clara's gaze darted between the photo and the woman, confusion mounting. Then the woman reached across the table, her cold fingers brushing Clara's hand. A jolt surged through her, and suddenly, memories flooded in running through these halls as a child, laughter echoing, the smell of lavender in her mother's arms. She stumbled back, clutching her head. What's happening? You were taken from this house, the woman said softly. Taken from me. I've been here ever since, waiting. Clara's breath hitched. The blurred faces in the photo sharpened in her mind's eye her parents, younger, happier. And then she understood. The woman wasn't just a stranger. She was her grandmother, preserved by some strange force in this house, tethered to it all these years. But the truth hit her as she looked down at her own hands that now shimmered faintly, translucent in the candlelight. She hadn't just come to uncover a secret. She'd come because she, too, had died long ago, and this house was calling her home. The key detail that Clara is a ghost remains hidden until the final sentence, recontextualizing the entire story. Did it catch you off guard? Purpose of life. This is just me picking a topic and commenting about everything that comes to mind, exploring various perspectives and insights that might be relevant. I find that expressing my thoughts can lead to a deeper understanding of not only the topic itself but also how it connects to broader themes and issues in my life, stimulating further discussion and engagement with others who may have different viewpoints. Through this process of reflection, I uncover layers of meaning that I hadn't considered before, allowing me to engage more thoughtfully with the complexities of the world around me. I am near the end of my journey, and I am reconciling my life and what I could have done better in events and experiences I have been confronted with. It's a time of introspection, where I assess not only my choices and values but also how those decisions have shaped my relationships and impacted my personal growth. By acknowledging my past, I hope to embrace the lessons learned and apply them to future endeavors, fostering a sense of purpose and clarity that drives me toward a more fulfilling existence. Discovering your purpose in life is a deeply personal journey, but there are steps you can take to explore and uncover what brings meaning to you. To begin, take some time for self-reflection, consider what activities and experiences have historically brought you joy and fulfillment. Engaging in journaling can be a productive method to articulate your thoughts and feelings about your passions and values. Additionally, seek feedback from those who know you well, they may offer insights into your strengths and the aspects of life where you shine brightest. Don't hesitate to explore new interests, as trying new things can spark inspiration and lead you to unexpected paths. Here are some ideas to get started. Reflect on what excites you, think deeply about activities or moments that make you lose track of time or fill you with joy and excitement. What are you passionate about? Consider how these interests not only bring you happiness, but also how they shape your life and influence your personal and professional goals. Identify your values. Consider what truly matters to you: kindness, creativity, growth, connection, etc. Reflect deeply on these aspects of your life to understand their significance. Mapping out your values can prompt important questions about your decisions and lifestyle. Aligning your actions with your core values often leads to a profound sense of purpose and fulfillment, guiding your choices and interactions in both personal and professional arenas. Embrace curiosity, try new hobbies, explore different fields, and meet diverse people. Sometimes, purpose is discovered in unexpected places, and by stepping outside of your comfort zone, you might uncover hidden passions or interests that inspire you. Engaging with various activities allows for personal growth and new perspectives on life. Embracing new adventures, no matter how big or small, can lead to meaningful connections and experiences that enrich your journey. Acknowledge your talents, reflect on your strengths and skills. Take time to consider how you can use them to contribute positively to others or the world around you. By recognizing your unique abilities, you open up opportunities for personal growth and the potential to inspire those around you. Emphasizing your talents can lead to meaningful connections and impactful contributions in various aspects of life, from your community to your workplace and beyond. Practice mindfulness, take time to sit quietly with your thoughts and reflect on your day or week. It can be beneficial to engage in activities such as journaling or meditation, as these practices can help you tune into your inner voice, allowing for greater self-awareness and understanding of your emotions. Connect with others, talk to people you admire, seek mentorship, or join communities aligned with your interests. Engaging in meaningful conversations and sharing experiences can lead to valuable insights that might inspire your own path. Participating actively in discussions can also help you expand your network and open up new opportunities you may not have considered before. Give back, volunteering or helping others can bring a profound sense of fulfillment and might lead you closer to what feels purposeful, as it connects you with your community, allows you to develop new skills, and fosters deeper relationships with those around you. A purpose doesn't have to be monumental, it could be as simple as spreading kindness, being present for loved ones, or pursuing what makes your heart sing. Experience delicious meals at Dee's Cafe. My favorite restaurant is Dee's Cafe. It is warm and friendly, creating an inviting atmosphere that makes you feel at home the moment you step inside. The decor is charming, with cozy seating and vibrant colors that give it a unique character. The only time it is crowded is during the holidays, when families gather to enjoy a delightful meal together. The cooking is terrific and always tasty, with a diverse menu that showcases both comfort food and seasonal specialties crafted from fresh, local ingredients. The travel time is very short, making it a convenient option for a spontaneous dinner or a planned outing, and parking is never a problem, allowing guests to arrive without any stress. I have known the cook for over 40 years, and we get along very well. Our friendship has grown over countless shared meals and laughter, and always knows how to accommodate my favorite dishes, making each visit even more special. Yes, I am writing about Dee's Cafe, and the owner is my wife. It is amazing that I am not over 250 pounds the way she feeds Maine with her incredible culinary skills and passion for creating delicious meals that tantalize the taste buds. From the moment you walk into the cafe, the aroma of freshly brewed coffee and baked goods envelopes you, making it hard to resist indulging in her daily specials. Hopefully, we will have many more years of dining together, savoring the delightful dishes she prepares, and sharing all the conversations we have about the events and situations in our life together, reflecting on cherished memories and dreaming of future adventures. Each meal is not just about the food but also about the love and warmth that fills the space, making Dee's Cafe a true heartwarming corner of our lives. Tale of Two Strangers. In a dusty eastern Colorado town, 70-year-old retiree Lulu runs a struggling diner, her days filled with greasy plates and lonelier nights since her husband passed, leaving an emptiness that seems to seep into the very walls around her. Each morning, she wakes before dawn, the familiar hum of the coffee maker breaking the silence of an empty house, a sound that has become a comfort and a ritual, grounding her in a world that feels increasingly alien. After brewing a pot of strong coffee, she heads to the diner where the walls echo with memories of happier times, laughter, and bustling customers, now replaced with the grim reality of only a few loyal patrons who come to escape their lives as much as she does. Across the street, 19-year-old Juan, a graffiti artist with a rap sheet, tags abandoned walls, dodging cops, and his own dead-end future, caught in a cycle of choices that often lead him deeper into trouble. He is always searching for a way to express the turmoil within him, the feelings of alienation and frustration that swirl in his soul, causing him to lash out through his art. His nights are spent weaving through the shadows, paint cans in hand, as he transforms the dull gray of the urban landscape with bursts of color and emotion, each stroke telling a story of his struggles and dreams. Their paths cross one fateful afternoon when Lulu unexpectedly catches Diego spray painting her diner's back alley, his hands moving deftly as he creates a vibrant mural, brimming with life and energy. Instead of calling the police, she offers him a burger, seeing hunger in his eyes beyond the defiance, recognizing a desperation that mirrors her own loneliness. In that brief encounter, she offers him a fleeting moment of connection amid their contrasting lives, a shared understanding that transcends the barriers of age and experience, revealing the fragile threads that connect them in a world that often feels isolating. Juan, weary but broke, accepts the unexpected invitation, and they talk first about nothing, then about everything that matters. Lulu shares vivid stories of her diner's glory days, reminiscing about the bustling atmosphere and the laughter that filled the air. Juan, drawn in by her enthusiasm, admits he paints to feel alive, a passion that he's always kept hidden. She sees his undeniable talent, he sees her fierce grit, a contrast that intrigues him. Soon, Juan's sneaking in after hours to paint a magnificent mural on the diner's wall, a vibrant prairie scene alive with color that attracts curious crowds from all over town. Lulu teaches him to cook, showing him the delicate art of flipping pancakes and seasoning dishes just right, and in return, he teaches her to laugh again, their banter becoming light and effortless, infused with warmth. Locals whisper about the odd pair, a painter and a diner owner, but the diner's buzzing with newfound life, and so are they, their connection deepening with each shared moment and stolen glance, weaving a tapestry of hope and healing amidst the backdrop of grease and paint. When developers threaten to buy Lulu's land, Juan inspires the town with his art, transforming the diner into a vibrant cause that brings everyone together. They unite enthusiastically, not just for the diner but for the cherished home they've built together, a sanctuary filled with laughter, stories, and unforgettable moments. As the townsfolk come together, they create stunning banners and murals, all bursting with color and passion, beautifully reflecting their shared history and joyful memories. In the end, it's not merely about winning, it's about the beautiful family they've formed in each other, two misfits who turned a run-down joint into a masterpiece, a beacon of resilience and hope, proving that love and community can triumph over corporate greed. The edge of nightmares, confronting the unknown. Sometimes I have the strangest dreams, where the boundaries of reality blur and the impossible becomes palpable, weaving intricate stories that leave me questioning their origins as I wake, caught between the allure of the bizarre and the comfort of my everyday life. These dreams transport me to fantastical realms where gravity loses its grip and colors pulsate with life, inviting me to dance with shadows and converse with whispers of forgotten tales. In this surreal tapestry, I often find myself on the precipice of fear and wonder, exploring landscapes that defy logic, yet feel oddly familiar, as if they were fragments of my own forgotten memories. As I drift further into slumber, the lines between my day-to-day existence and these vividly twisted narratives continue to intertwine, drawing me into a hypnotic cycle of fantasy that is both thrilling and unsettling. I guess I should watch what I eat for supper. I steady myself on the jagged cliff's edge, the volcanic wasteland sprawling before me like a nightmare carved in fire and stone. The heat rising from the glowing fissures sears my skin even through your worn-out gear, and the ash in the air clings to my face, gritty and relentless. That low rumble grows into a bone-deep shudder, and a plume of sparks erupts from a nearby crevasse, showering the ground with flecks of molten light. The cliff groans under my weight, a hairline fracture spider-webbing out from my boot times not on my side here. Below, the twisted metal spires glint dully through the haze, their skeletal frames half buried in drifts of blackened sand. You squint and catch more movement, those shadows aren't just tricks of the light. They're humanoid, but they're jerky, deliberate motions suggest they're either desperate or deranged, maybe both. One pauses, head tilting as if it's caught my scent on the wind, and a glint of something sharp flashes in its hand. Bandits, scavengers, or survivors gone feral, doesn't matter their trouble. Beyond them, a faint green flicker pulses from one of the spires, maybe a working power source or a trap waiting to spring. My satchel slaps against my hip as I shift, the weight of its meager contents a grim reminder of your odds. The energy cells got enough juice for a single burst, maybe to power a tool or fry something coming at me, but it's a one-shot deal. The canteen's metal is dented, water sloshing low, barely enough to wet my throat in this furnace. The comms device crackles again, spitting out a distorted fragment, sector breach, containment failing, before it dies back into static. Could be a warning, could be old noise, either way, it's not calling for help anytime soon. That howl cuts through the air again, closer now, reverberating off the cliffs. I risk a glance over my shoulder and spot something loping through the ash clouds, a hulking shape, too big for a man, its outline bristling with spines or jagged plating. It's not rushing me yet, but it's circling, testing. The wind shifts, carrying a stench of sulfur and rot, and you realize it's not alone, smaller shapes skitter in its wake, like pups trailing a predator. The cliff's fracture widens with a sickening crunch, echoing through the still air and sending a jolt of adrenaline through my veins, forcing me to decide between dropping down toward the jagged spires below, where darkness lurks and the shadows seem to breathe with menace, or backtracking into the desolate wastes where that relentless creature is stalking my every move. The green flicker in the distance pulses again, a beacon of uncertainty that tempts me with the slim chance of salvage or a fleeting sanctuary, but I wonder if it's a mirage, a cruel trick played by the landscape to ensnare me further in danger. My hand hovers over the energy cell, the weight of my choices pressing heavily on my chest, pulse hammering in my ears as I grip it tightly, trying to quell the rising tide of panic and indecision that threatens to paralyze me. What's my play? Each option seems fraught with peril, yet the instinct for survival urges me to act before the cliff crumbles further, plunging me into deeper chaos. Fortunately, I woke up. Midnight Spooky Tale. It's 11:57 p.m. on April 4th, 2025, and the air feels thick with something unspoken. Shadows stretch long and jagged across the floor, like fingers clawing at the edges of reality. The clock ticks louder than it should, each second a hammer against the silence. Outside, the wind howls low, a mournful sound that rattles the windows like something's trying to get in. You're alone, Or at least you think you are. The room's dim, lit only by the sickly glow of your screen, and every creak of the house feels like a whisper you can't quite catch. Did you lock the door? You're pretty sure you did, but the thought gnaws at you. There's a chill creeping up your spine, slow and deliberate, like icy fingertips tracing their way to your neck. Somewhere in the distance, a dog barks sharp, frantic, then stops abruptly. Too abruptly. The silence that follows is heavier than before, pressing down on your chest. You glance at the clock, 11:58. Time's slipping away, but it feels wrong, like it's stalling just to mess with you. There's a story they tell around here, about nights like this. They say the veil thins out close to midnight, when the world holds its breath. Things slip through, things that don't belong. You've heard the tales, footsteps where no one's walking, shadows that don't match their owners, voices calling your name from rooms you swore were empty. Old folks swear they've seen it, eyes wide and hands trembling as they recount it over flickering candles. 11:59, the screen flickers, just for a second, and you blink. Did you see something in the reflection? A shape behind you, too vague to be sure, too real to ignore? You turn, heart thudding, but there's nothing. Just the room, still and dark. The wind picks up again, and this time it carries something, a low, guttural hum that doesn't sound like wind at all. Midnight hits. The clock chimes, but it's off, warped, like it's underwater. The lights dim, then surge, casting the room in a strobe of light and shadow. And then you hear it, a soft tap tap tap, slow and deliberate, coming from the window. You don't want to look. Every nerve screams not to. But your eyes betray you, sliding toward the glass. There's nothing there. Just darkness. Except, is that a smudge on the pane? A handprint, faint and streaked, like someone or something pressed against it from the outside. It wasn't there before. You're sure of it. The tapping stops. The silence is worse. And then, from somewhere deep in the house, a floorboard groans. Not near you. Not upstairs. Somewhere else. Somewhere it shouldn't. Happy almost midnight. Sleep tight if you can. The wind and the house. The wind howled through the empty house, whispering Tom in the dark. I stood at the threshold of the old Schuler estate, my breath fogging in the frigid night air, my flashlight trembling in my hand. It was a dare from my friends Jack, Mike, and Florence because they knew I couldn't resist proving them wrong. They'd spent weeks spinning tales about this place, how the Schuler family vanished in 73, how neighbors swore they heard screams years after, how the house sat untouched, rotting on the edge of town like a festering mound. It's just a creepy old dump, I'd said, smirking, but now, with the warped door creaking open under my push, my bravado felt thin as the mist curling around my ankles. Inside, the air was stale, heavy with dust and something sour I couldn't place. My flashlight beam swept over peeling wallpaper, furniture draped in moldy sheets, and a grandfather clock frozen at 3:17, its pendulum dangling like a broken limb. The silence was oppressive, but then the floorboards groaned behind me, a slow, deliberate creak, as if someone had shifted their weight. I spun around, hard hammering, but there was nothing, just the gaping doorway and the night beyond. Hello. I called, my voice swallowed by the house. No answer, only the wind rattling the shutters like a caged animal desperate to get in or out. I pressed deeper, past a dining room where plates sat untouched, crusted with decades-old food, and up a staircase that sagged under my steps. Each creak felt like a warning, but I told myself it was just the house settling, not the presence I swore I felt watching me. A cold draft brushed the back of my neck, prickling my skin, and I turned again, nothing but shadows. Except now the shadows seemed wrong, elongated and twisting, like fingers reaching from the walls. My flashlight flickered, and in that stuttering light, I glimpsed something, a shape darting across the hall, too fast to be real, too human to be imagination. The attic door was at the end of the corridor, its paint chipped into a jagged grin. I don't know why I climbed those final stairs, maybe it was the dare, maybe it was the pull of something I couldn't name. The attic smelled of mildew and rust, cluttered with boxes spilling yellowed letters and faded photographs of the Schulers' smiling faces that didn't match the stories. In the corner stood a cracked mirror, its frame warped and blackened, and when I looked into it, my breath caught. My reflection wasn't mine. It was hers, Eleanor Schuler, the woman who'd disappeared last, her portrait still hanging in the town hall. Her eyes were pits of ink, her mouth a crooked gash stretching wider than any human's should, and she stared back at me, unblinking. I stumbled back, the flashlight dropping with a clatter, plunging me into darkness. The air thickened, pressing against my chest, and the walls began to throb a slow, rhythmic pulse like a heartbeat echoing through the house. Footsteps thudded below, heavy and deliberate, climbing the stairs. I grabbed the flashlight, its beam weak now, and ran, the attic door slamming shut behind me with a force that shook the frame. The stairs twisted under my feet, the wood bending as if trying to trap me, and I half fell, half leaped down, my hands scraping against splinters and something wet that smelled of copper. The hallway stretched longer than before, the front door a distant speck. Behind me, the footsteps grew louder, joined by a low, guttural hum that vibrated in my bones. I didn't dare look back, I couldn't. When I reached the door, it wouldn't budge, the knob icy and slick under my palms, but with a desperate shove, it gave way, and I spilled onto the porch, gulping the night air. The house loomed behind me, its windows dark and accusing, and I ran down the overgrown path, past the rusted gate, not stopping until I hit the road where my car waited. I fumbled with the keys, my hands shaking so badly I dropped them twice, and when I finally looked up, the house was still there, silhouetted against the moon. Safe, I thought, leaning back in the driver's seat, my pulse slowing. But then the wind picked up, slicing through the trees with a sound too sharp, too alive. It wasn't just wind, it was her voice, Eleanor's, low and insistent, threading through the noise, calling my name Tom. I froze, staring at the house, and in the upstairs window, a figure stood, its head tilted, its smile too wide. The car wouldn't start. The air grew colder. And I knew, with a sinking dread, that I hadn't escaped at all she'd let me think I had, just to pull me back. The wind howled through the empty house, whispering Tom in the dark. Celebrating Fool's Day. In a chaotic village perched precariously between the undulating hills of medieval France and the eerie shadows of the Loire Valley, a cunning jester named Pipkin thrived. It was 1564, an era of upheaval where the villagers found themselves grappling with a world turned upside down. Just a short time ago, King Charles IX had announced a radical change. The new year would no longer kick off with extravagant feasts and debauchery on April 1st but instead would commence on January 1st, dragging France into the rigid confines of the Gregorian calendar. Those pitiful souls clinging to the outdated tradition of welcoming the year in spring were ridiculed as April fools, their refusal to adapt a mere punchline in the eyes of the so-called enlightened. Pipkin, the neighborhood prankster extraordinaire, spotted a golden opportunity in the chaos unfolding around him. Unlike the gloomy folks sweating it out in the fields or bartering over sheep fur like it was the last cookie at a bake sale, he skipped through life with a mischievous grin and a pouch bursting with enough tricks to rival a magician's arsenal. The villagers loved him most of the time except for those moments when his notorious pranks left them blushing brighter than a beet or swimming in a puddle of ale. But this year, Pipkin made an oath to turn the king's quirky calendar shuffle into a party so unforgettable, even the sourpusses would be tempted to crack a smile. As spring arrived, the first day of April in 1564 was bright and fresh. The village was excited because Pipkin had called it Fool's Day, a reminder of those still giving New Year's gifts 3 months late. No one knew why he liked this day. Some said it was because he once tricked old Farmer Grum into thinking his cow could sing. But Pipkin just smiled and said, "A fool needs no reason." That morning, Pipkin woke with a plan grander than any before. He scurried about, planting surprises like seeds in a garden. By noon, the village was a riot of chaos and glee. Baker Tom pulled a loaf from his oven only to find it squawked like a chicken. Pipkin had slipped a tiny bellows inside the dough, a trick he'd learned from a wandering Italian jungler. Widow Mara opened her door to a tax collector, demanding payment in turnips, only to realize it was Pipkin in a borrowed cloak, mimicking the royal officials who'd enforced the new calendar. Even the stern blacksmith, Gorham, roared with laughter when his hammer turned to rubber mid-strike, bouncing off the anvil a jest inspired by tales of Dutch pranksters Pipkin had heard at the tavern. But Pipkin's big moment was waiting for the evening when everyone in the village came together for the spring feast, kind of like their old New Year's parties. As the sun started to set, painting the sky in cool shades of orange and purple, Pipkin hopped up on a barrel and started clapping his hands. "Hey folks," he yelled. "Check out the wildest joke of all, a treat for all the goofballs from the past and present." With a dramatic pull, he yanked on a rope, and from the trees came a shower of sparkling dust. The crowd gasped as it rained down on them, then blinked in confusion. Nothing happened. No magical changes, no funny stuff, just a little sparkle on their shoulders. "Is this your trick, Pipkin?" grumbled Gorum, brushing the dust off his beard. "A bit of sparkle and naught else." Pipkin's grin widened. "Look closer, my friends." The villagers squinted and then erupted into laughter as if they'd just discovered a hidden treasure. The dust wasn't just any old sparkle, it was like a winking mirror reflecting their hearts, playfully echoing the French tradition of calling April 1st, Poisson d'Avril, or April Fish, for those who bit on pranks like a hungry bass. Throughout the night, every word was a comedy act, compliments morphed into cheeky roasts, grumbles transformed into zany jests, and even the bashful folks loosened up as if they'd chugged a gallon of giggles. Widow Mara poked fun at Tom's infamous foul bread, while Gorum sheepishly confessed he had a secret crush on the rubber hammer. The feast turned into a riotous symphony of laughter, echoing louder and friendlier than any past New Year's party ever could. As the clock hit midnight, the dust cleared, and the village slipped into a comfy quiet. Pipkin, sitting on his barrel, watched everyone head home, their grins hanging around like stars. He'd done more than just pull a prank, he'd flipped the king's decree into a wild day of fun and rebellion, a party for those who once celebrated the year back in April. From then on, April 1st was known as Fool's Day across the land, spreading beyond France to England, Scotland, and even the New World in time. This day became a canvas for joy and mischief, a celebration of laughter that echoed through towns and villages, where residents plotted playful tricks, each year trying to outdo the last. Pipkin never revealed where he'd found that magical dust. Some said it came from a gypsy trader, others from a monk with a sense of humor, but each year, he'd wink and say, "A fool's best trick is to make you one too." His enigmatic charm only fueled the tradition, which flourished and grew, blending with tales of fish pinned to backs and mock gifts for the forgetful, as children and adults alike became embroiled in the exhilarating spirit of the day, creating unforgettable memories, all thanks to a jester who saw history's shifts as a stage for laughter, ensuring that the essence of fun and camaraderie would endure through the ages. My car speaks out. I am a 2022 Honda HR-V, a compact yet mighty crossover, designed to navigate the urban jungle with a touch of adventure. My story begins in the bright, bustling lot of a Honda dealership, where I gleamed under the sun, my coat of urban gray metallic catching the eyes of passers-by. My owner, Tom, found me on a crisp autumn day. He circled around, inspecting my sleek lines and spacious interior. I could feel his approval as he ran his hands over my alloy wheels and checked out my cargo space. There was an instant connection, and soon, I was rolling out of the dealership, my engine purring with excitement. The first journey with Tom was memorable. We ventured out of the city, and I found myself navigating through winding country roads, my all-wheel drive system gripping the pavement with confidence. The scenery was a blur of colors, but I felt every curve, every incline, as if I were part of the landscape itself. Life with Tom was full of small adventures. We'd often drive to the local park where he'd open my tailgate, revealing the convenience of my magic seat feature, perfect for his weekend camping gear or a quick picnic. I loved those moments when the sun set, casting golden rays through my windows, warming the interior while Tom enjoyed his Gatorade. Winter arrived, and I proved my mettle. With my heated seats and climate control, we kept cozy even on the chilliest days. The snow didn't daunt me, my snow mode ensured we navigated through the white landscapes with ease. There was a sense of pride when I managed to get us out of the snowy parking lots where others were stuck. But it wasn't all about the adventures. I was there for the mundane too, the daily commutes, the grocery runs, the quiet drives to the library or to visit friends. Each journey, no matter how short, was a chance for me to serve and to be appreciated. Tom would sometimes talk to me, not expecting a reply, but I listened. I heard about his day, his plans, his hopes. It made me feel like more than just a vehicle, I was a companion. Then there was the music. Tom loved his tunes, and my audio system was just right for him, filling the cabin with his favorite beats, making each drive a little concert. The joy of music, the beat matching the rhythm of my engine, it was a harmony unique to us. Tom was overjoyed when he discovered my UBS feature. Now he can bring thousands of his favorites copied onto a thumb drive and never hear the same song twice. One day, we took a long road trip. The open road was liberating, the horizon endless. My fuel efficiency meant fewer stops, more miles under my wheels. We saw mountains, forests, and at one point, we pulled over at a viewpoint. Tom sat on my hood, watching the sunset, and I felt a sense of accomplishment for bringing him to such a beautiful place. As time passed, I've seen maintenance days, oil changes, tire rotations, but each visit to the mechanic was a testament to how well Tom cared for me. I was not just a machine, I was a part of his life, his story. Now, as I sit here, perhaps parked in the garage, I look back on these days with fondness. I've been more than a vehicle, I've been a part of Tom's journey, his companion through the seasons, through the ups and downs. Here's to many more adventures, to the bond that forms between a car and its owner, to the road less traveled, and to the road yet to come. The end of the road. The garage was a shrine of grease and memory, its air thick with the scent of motor oil and faded dreams. Elias stood in the shadowed space, his hands shoved deep into his pockets, staring at the car that had been his heartbeat for a decade. The 67 Mustang gleamed under the flickering fluorescent light, midnight blue, chrome polished to a mirror shine, every curve a testament to the years he'd spent bringing her back to life. He loved her more than anything he'd ever known, from the days of tinkering with her engine to the late nights spent on long drives down empty roads, feeling the rush of the wind against his face as the engine roared to life. Every scratch on her surface held a story, each dent a memory of adventure and freedom that now seemed so far away. But now, standing in the garage, that bittersweet nostalgia twisted in his gut in a way he had never anticipated, for he had to destroy her. It felt like tearing apart a piece of his own soul, a sacrifice made in the name of moving forward, even if doing so meant leaving behind the one thing that had always understood him, the one constant in a world full of change and uncertainty. The call had come that afternoon, clipped and cold from a voice he didn't recognize. "We know about the car. Stolen van, traced back to a chop shop bust in 09. Crush it by morning, or we turn you in. Your choice." Choice. What a joke. Turning himself in meant jail, losing everything, his shop, his name, the life he'd clawed out of nothing, piece by piece, through relentless grit and determination. Crushing her meant he could keep breathing, prolong the fleeting moments of freedom he had left, and try to find a way out of the suffocating mess he now found himself in. He'd cursed into the phone, slammed it down, pacing the garage until his boots wore a groove in the dust, the weight of the decision pressing heavily on his chest. The flickering fluorescent light overhead cast shadows that danced like specters of his past decisions, taunting him. But the math didn't lie. One way he lost her, the other he lost everything else. Each option felt like a sentence, a countdown to an inevitable loss that seemed to mock his every effort. Desperation clawed at him, urging him to think of a way out, yet his heart raced with the fear of what lay ahead, the unknown playing cruel tricks on his imagination, as he wrestled with the reality of his choices. She wasn't just a car. She was the summer he'd found her, rusted out in a junkyard, a skeleton of what she could be, a forgotten relic left to decay under the unrelenting sun. He'd rebuilt her piece by piece, nights spent hunched under the hood, hands black with grease, radio crackling old rock tunes, the air thick with the sweet scent of gasoline and promise. Each bolt he tightened, each dent he hammered out, brought not only life back to her body but also a sense of purpose to his own weary soul. She'd carried him through the worst of it, the divorce that shattered his heart, the bank breathing down his neck with threats that felt all too real, the days he didn't want to get up, when the weight of the world seemed unbearable. Her engine's roar was the sound of freedom, an anthem to the resilience that silently painted his days with newfound color, her wheel under his hands the only thing that ever felt like home, a sanctuary amidst the chaos. He'd named her Lola, whispered to her like she could hear him, sharing his secrets and dreams, and maybe she could, wrapped in the mystery of their bond, an unspoken understanding that transcended words. Together, they forged memories on winding roads, their adventure and escape, as the miles stretched beneath them like the fabric of a life reborn. The sledgehammer leaned against the workbench, its head dull and heavy, a silent testament to the destruction about to unfold. Elias picked it up, feeling the weight settle into his bones, a physical reminder of the decision he had made. His throat tightened as he stepped closer, the Mustang's grill staring back like a loyal dog that didn't know what was coming, its once pristine shine now a cruel contrast to his growing fury. He raised the hammer, hesitated for just a moment as memories flooded his mind, the late nights spent polishing the chrome, weekends dedicated to tuning the engine, and dreams of cruising down the coast. With a deep breath, he brought it down. The windshield shattered with a sound like a gunshot, glass spraying across the hood in a million tiny facets that sparkled in the light, an ironic beauty to the chaos. He swung again, denting the fender he'd spent months perfecting, the metal groaning under the blow as if it were mourning its own fate. Each hit was a wound, headlights smashed, doors caved in with a satisfying crunch, the roof buckling like a broken spine under relentless assault. His arms burned, sweat dripping into his eyes as his breath came in ragged bursts, yet he didn't stop, he couldn't stop, driven by an emotion he could hardly name, until she was unrecognizable, a heap of twisted steel and shattered pride, a manifestation of all his frustration and loss, standing as a grim reminder of what he once cherished and had been forced to destroy. When it was over, he dropped the hammer, his hands trembling, knuckles flecked with blood where the skin had split. The garage was silent except for the drip of coolant pooling beneath her corpse, a tragic reminder of the devastating decision he had made. He'd killed her. 10 years of late nights spent in the glow of fluorescent lights, of scrounging for parts from rickety salvage yards, of feeling alive every time he turned the key, all gone in 20 minutes of a blinding moment fueled by panic and desperation. He could have fought, could have tracked down the bastard on the phone, taken the risk that lingered in the back of his mind like a ghost, he could have saved her. But he'd chosen survival over loyalty, sacrificing everything that had once mattered to him for a fleeting chance at escape. The shame of it burned worse than the ache in his shoulders, a searing guilt that wrapped around him like a vice, squeezing out any semblance of comfort he might have found in the remnants of his former life. The tools that had once brought him joy now lay scattered, mocking him with their uselessness as he stood there, grappling with the irreversible reality of what he had done. Tomorrow, he'd haul what was left to the scrapyard, watch the crusher finish what he'd started, and tell himself it was worth it. The cops wouldn't come, the shop would stay open, life would grind on. But tonight, Elias sank onto the cold concrete, staring at the wreckage of the thing he'd loved most, his heart heavy with memories. The echo of her engine still ringing in his ears, a haunting melody of joy and freedom now turned to sorrow. The garage felt emptier than it ever had, and so did he, as he reminisced about the countless nights spent tinkering, the laughter shared, the dreams discussed under the flickering fluorescent lights. Each dent and scratch on the car told a story, a testament to their journey together, and now, with the realization that it was all coming to an end, a deep sense of loss enveloped him. Each breath felt labored as he mourned not just the loss of the car, but the pieces of himself that had been intertwined with it, leaving an ache that would linger long after the metal was crushed and gone. The forgotten letter. Jeff was rummaging through his grandmother's attic when he stumbled upon an old dresser, its chipped paint revealing layers of forgotten colors beneath, and its creaky drawers protesting with each movement. As he peered closer, a curious sensation washed over him, compelling him to investigate further. Feeling something odd behind the dresser, he moved it aside with a careful nudge, revealing an envelope wedged tightly against the wall, yellowed and brittle with age, coated in a fine layer of dust that spoke to years of neglect. The postmark reads, March 16, 1942, and his heart quickens as he realizes it's addressed to a name he doesn't recognize, Roseanne Westbrook. Intrigued, he examines the envelope more closely, noting there's no return address to provide any clues about the sender, just a faded stamp and a wax seal, cracked but intact, bearing an unfamiliar crest, a snake with a key in its mouth that left him wondering about the secrets contained within this unexpected discovery. What stories were hidden in the words that lay inside, and who was the mysterious Roseanne Westbrook? Curiosity gets the better of him. He peels it open, careful not to tear the fragile paper, marveling at the way the sunlight catches the edges, illuminating the delicate fibers woven into its texture. Inside, the handwriting is elegant but shaky, as if written in a hurry or under strain, revealing the urgency behind the words crafted on the page. The letter begins with a flourish, yet there's an underlying tremor that suggests a deep-seated fear or a profound longing, drawing him further into the unfolding story that lies within these lines. He hesitates for a moment, sensing that what follows may change everything he thought he knew. Roseanne, if you're reading this, it means I failed. The house isn't safe anymore. They know where it is, and they'll come for it next, relentless and hungry for the secrets it holds. Keep the key hidden, buried deep where only you can find it, far from prying eyes. Trust no one, not even yourself, as doubts can creep in like shadows at dusk, clouding your judgment. Burn this when you're done, but first, remember every detail of our time there, the walls whisper with memories that could unravel everything we've built. Your safety depends on your vigilance. Stay alert and be prepared to act swiftly if they come for you. It's signed only with an initial, L. Tucked into the envelope is a small, tarnished brass key, its teeth worn but intricate, like it belongs to something old and important, perhaps a treasure chest filled with memories or a long-forgotten diary holding secrets waiting to be uncovered. There's no indication of who they are, what it is, or why Roseanne never got this letter, a mystery that weighs heavily in the air. Jeff never heard of a Roseanne Westbrook, yet he feels an inexplicable connection to the name, as if it echoes through time and space. The dresser's previous owner, a distant relative, maybe, or a stranger from an estate sale, offers no clues, leaving Jeff to ponder the significance of the key and the life of the woman it was meant for, igniting a flame of curiosity that fuels his imagination about the untold stories and hidden connections linking him to a past he never knew. At first, Jeff dismisses it as a quirky relic, a piece of someone else's story that has too carelessly found its way into his possession. But then, as the days pass, strange things start happening, and what once felt innocuous now feels unsettlingly invasive. Jeff notices a car lingering too long outside his house, its driver obscured by tinted windows, watching as if waiting for something significant to occur. A faint tapping echoes from the walls at night, like something, or someone searching, probing with an urgency that sends shivers down his spine. Each night, the sounds grow more pronounced, the air thick with an unshakable tension. And the key, which you left on your nightstand, keeps turning up in odd places, your coat pocket, the fridge, the bottom of a drawer he hadn't opened in weeks, as if it has a will of its own, taunting him with its mysterious reappearances. He begins to wonder if these occurrences are all connected, weaving a web of intrigue that pulls him deeper into a narrative he feels he doesn't fully understand. The letter changes his life in ways you couldn't predict. Maybe Jeff should start digging into Roseanne's Westbrook identity, uncovering a trail of missing persons reports that leads him down a dark alley of forgotten stories, a house that burned down decades ago with whispers of tragedy surrounding it, or a local legend about a hidden vault no one's ever found, said to hold secrets that could unravel the very fabric of his understanding. As he delves deeper, he wonders if the key itself begins to unlock not just physical doors, but also the very essence of reality, a door in Jeff's basement that wasn't there before, beckoning him with an eerie aura, a memory that feels like it belongs to someone else, complete with vivid details he cannot explain, or a long-buried secret about his own family that he was never meant to uncover, one that casts a shadow over his entire past. The more Jeff learns, the more he realizes they might still be out there, and now they're watching him, lurking in the corners of his life, waiting patiently for the moment he strays too far into the depths of what was supposed to remain hidden. Who was Roseanne Westbrook, and why didn't she get the letter that seemed to hold the weight of the world? Was she truly betrayed by those closest to her, lying in eternal silence, or had she simply vanished from the clutches of her reality when it arrived? The implications of that letter are profound. What does the key within it unlock? A physical place steeped in history, a long-buried secret that could alter everything, or perhaps something far more supernatural that defies explanation? And then there is the enigmatic figure known only as L. Who are they, and what crucial task did they fail to undertake that changed the course of so many lives? Are they still alive, lurking in the shadows, waiting for the moment when someone will finally finish what they started, or have they too disappeared into obscurity? This intricate web of mystery reshapes Jeff's life in ways he could never have anticipated, pushing him into uncharted territories of despair and hope. Yet, the ultimate question lingers like a haunting refrain. One may never truly know the answers, as Jeff mysteriously disappeared and was never seen again, leaving behind a trail of questions that may never find resolution. Rover and Sox. Rover, hey, Sox. What's the deal with your windowsill throne? Do you think you're the Queen of England or just auditioning for a feline royal reality show? I mean, lounging there like you own the place, with your snooty little nose in the air while the birds put on their daily aerial show, do you even lift a paw? I can't decide if you're a majestic ruler or just an expert sunbather. Seriously, what goes through that fluffy head of yours as you plot world domination from your sunny perch? Sox, because I do own the place, Rover. It's a tough job being this fabulous, but someone's got to do it. You see, it's called being superior, a title that comes with the royal perks of elegance and grace, which apparently you missed out on while frolicking in a tail-chasing frenzy. Meanwhile, I'm up here surveying my domain, looking regal from the highest perch while you tumble into yet another round of your never-ending antics. It's a demanding life of leisure and poise, one that requires a level of finesse that clearly zipped right past your wagging tail. Rover, tail-chasing is all the rage. Seriously, You should give it a whirl instead of snoozing like a bear in hibernation. Live a little. There's nothing quite like the sheer thrill of zooming in circles, wind flapping your fur like those ridiculous car ads, and feeling like the king of your own hilarious chase. It's not just a game, it's a cardio workout disguised as fun. Just think, you can turn the most boring day into an epic adventure with a little tail-twirling chaos. So let that inner goofball shine, lose yourself in the delight of chasing your own tail, and who knows, you might just discover the secret to a happier life is all in the spin. Cat, napping is basically my superpower, you drooling furball. I'm just recharging my batteries for the crucial duties ahead, like my not-so-secret mission of judging the humans, who hilariously think they run this place. While I blissfully doze, I'm orchestrating my next regal takeover, all while mildly entertained by their daily circus acts. It's a riot watching them dash around, tackling one errand after another, completely oblivious to the divine joys of a sunbeam or a rogue feather swaying in the breeze. Trust me, my naps aren't just for show, they're tactical retreats, moments for plotting my rightful reign over this household. Rover, judging? I'd rather lick em. They're the best treats I could ever imagine. Who else gives me delicious snacks just for sitting? It's like magic. Every time I hear that rustle of the treat bag, my tail wags furiously, and I can hardly contain my excitement. The way they reward me makes me feel so loved and appreciated. It's not just about the food, but the bond we share whenever I perform my best tricks. Socks, ugh, your standards are so low. I get treats for existing, and it's called finesse. You see, it's not just about being present, it's about the charm and grace I bring to the room. I flaunt my adorable little paws in my irresistibly fluffy fur, and that's what gets me those delightful snacks. Why settle for less when I can dazzle everyone with my quirks? After all, who wouldn't want to spoil a pet with such an unmatched personality? It's all part of the game, and trust me, I'm winning it every day. Rover, finesse? More like laziness. Bet you can't catch a ball like I can. I've perfected my techniques after countless hours of practice in the park, chasing after sticks and bouncing balls, leaving my friends in awe of my skills. With my lightning-quick reflexes and unmatched enthusiasm, there's no doubt that I am the ultimate fetch champion. So, bring it on. Let's see you try to keep up with my agility and catching prowess. Socks, why would I catch a ball when I can catch a mouse? That's skill, not just slobbering after a toy. While the other dogs might chase after those brightly colored balls, I find a thrill in the chase that's much more adventurous and exciting. The soft rustling of tiny paws, the quick darting here and there, and the challenge of outsmarting my furry little opponent. It's a game of wits, and it requires precision and agility that goes beyond mere instinct. I relish the satisfaction of a well-executed capture, proving that I'm not just a plaything chaser but a true hunter at heart. Rover, mice are boring. You ever try barking at the mailman? Gets the blood pumping. There's nothing quite like the excitement of watching him approach, the way my fur bristles with anticipation as I prepare to make my move. The thrill builds in my chest, and I can't help but let out a few barks, expressing my excitement and guarding my territory. With every delivery, it's a new adventure, a chance to showcase my protective instincts and earn my place as the watchdog of the house. Plus, the look on the mailman's face is priceless. It's like I'm a part of a comedy show that's never quite the same from one day to the next. Socks, and wake up the whole neighborhood? No thanks. I prefer a quiet stalk, stealth is my style. There's something exhilarating about moving silently, slipping through the shadows where only the faintest whispers of wind can be heard. Each paw step is deliberate, calculated, as I navigate across the familiar terrain, evading the blaring sounds of daily life. The thrill of remaining unnoticed, blending into the dusk, allows me to observe without being seen, to feel the pulse of the night without disturbing its serenity. It's a dance of caution and cunning, where the thrill of the hunt mingles with the peace of solitude. Rover, stealth. You mean sneaking into my bed when I'm not looking, like a shadow in the night, quietly tiptoeing across the floor, as if on a secret mission? It's as if you have mastered the art of silent approach, waiting for the perfect moment to curl up beside me, while I'm blissfully unaware, wrapped up in my dreams. Socks, it is not sneaking, it is claiming what is mine. You are just too dumb to notice. Rover, well, I'll share it with you anyway. You're not so bad, Socks, in fact, I've come to appreciate your company more than I initially thought I would. It's surprising how two different personalities can find common ground and enjoy each other's presence. I've seen your cleverness in navigating tricky situations, and it's made me respect you a little more. After all, who would have thought that a dog and a cat could share stories under the stars and laugh at the silliest things together? Socks, humph. You're tolerable, I suppose, for a loud, smelly beast. Despite your constant racket, which often disrupts my peaceful moments, there's an undeniable charm in your antics. Your boisterous nature might be overwhelming at times, but it certainly brings a unique energy to the room. I find myself reluctantly drawn to your quirks, the way you bound around with excitement, even if it leaves a trail of chaos behind. So, while I may refer to you as a beast, I must admit that your presence adds a layer of unpredictability that, oddly enough, I can appreciate. Rover, wanna chase the squirrel outside together? It looks like it's darting around in the yard, and I can already feel the excitement building inside me. Just imagine the thrill of running after it, weaving through the trees and bushes while enjoying the fresh air and sunshine. What do you say we head out, let our energy loose, and see if we can catch that little critter before it scurries up a tree? Socks, fine. But I'm leading. When it comes to navigating through this tangled mess, I know exactly where to go. I've got a plan in mind, a clear direction that's been brewing for a while. You may have ideas too, but it's time to trust my instincts on this one. We can't afford to waste time wandering aimlessly, and I promise to keep everyone focused and on track. So let's gear up and follow my lead, because I have a feeling this is going to be quite the adventure. A surprising tale. The old house on the hill had stood empty for decades, its windows dark and its walls weathered by time. Clara had passed it every day on her way to town, always wondering about the stories it held. One crisp autumn evening, as the sun dipped low, she noticed something different, a faint flicker of light in the upstairs window. Curiosity tugged at her, and against her better judgment, she decided to investigate. The front door creaked open with surprising ease, as if it had been waiting for her. Inside, the air was thick with dust, and the faint scent of lavender lingered. Jada's footsteps echoed on the warped wooden floor as she climbed the stairs, drawn to the room where she'd seen the light. The door at the top was ajar, and a soft glow spilled out. In the room sat a woman, her back to Jada, hunched over a small table. She wore a faded dress, its hem frayed, and her silver hair cascaded down her back. A single candle burned before her, casting long shadows across the walls. Jada hesitated, then cleared her throat. The woman didn't turn. "I've been expecting you," she said, her voice low and steady. Jada froze. "Expecting me? I don't even know you." "You don't need to," the woman replied. "You're here for the truth, aren't you?" Jada's heart thudded. She hadn't told anyone she was coming, hadn't even known herself until moments ago. "What truth?" she asked, stepping closer. The woman gestured to a chair across the table. "Sit. I'll show you." On the table lay a small wooden box, intricately carved with swirling patterns. The woman slid it toward Jada. "Open it," she said. Hands trembling, Jada lifted the lid. Inside was a photograph, yellowed with age. It showed a young girl, no more than 5, with wide eyes and a shy smile, standing in front of this very house. A man and woman stood beside her, their faces blurred by time. Clara frowned. "Who is this?" The woman finally turned, her face illuminated by the candlelight. Her eyes were sharp, piercing, and oddly familiar. "Look closer," she said. Jada studied the photo again, then gasped. The girl's dress, the same faded fabric, the same frayed hem matched the one the woman wore now. "That's you," she stammered. The woman nodded. "I've waited a long time for you to come back." "Come back?" Jada's mind raced. "I've never been here before." The woman smiled faintly, a sad curve to her lips. "You have. You just don't remember." Jada's gaze darted between the photo and the woman, confusion mounting. Then the woman reached across the table, her cold fingers brushing Jada's hand. A jolt surged through her, and suddenly, memories flooded in running through these halls as a child, laughter echoing, the smell of lavender in her mother's arms. She stumbled back, clutching her head. "What's happening?" "You were taken from this house," the woman said softly. "Taken from me. I've been here ever since, waiting." Jada's breath hitched. The blurred faces in the photo sharpened in her mind's eye her parents, younger, happier. And then she understood. The woman wasn't just a stranger. She was her grandmother, preserved by some strange force in this house, tethered to it all these years. But the real truth hit her as she looked down at her own hands that now shimmered faintly, translucent in the candlelight. She hadn't just come to uncover a secret. She'd come because she, too, had died long ago, and this house was calling her home. The key detail that Jada is a ghost, did it catch you off guard? End of the line. The 11:47 p.m. express rattled through the night, its wheels screeching against the tracks as mist clung to the windows, blurring the patchy landscape beyond. I sat alone in the dimly lit car, the only passenger except for a man in a gray coat two rows ahead, shrouded in a shadow created by the flickering overhead lights. His head was bowed, hands folded in his lap, still as stone, a haunting figure amongst the empty seats. Outside, the rhythmic patter of rain began to fall, merging with the train's incessant clattering clack-clack. Clack-clack should have lulled me to sleep, but instead, a knot of unease tightened in my stomach. The air was thick with the scent of damp wood and metal, amplifying the isolation I felt in this moving coffin, and despite the familiarity of the sound, an instinctual dread settled over me, making it clear that something felt off. I'd noticed him when I boarded, sitting in the corner shrouded in shadows. He hadn't moved, hadn't spoken, hadn't even glanced at the conductor who'd passed through an hour ago, his feet firmly planted on the floor as if he were rooted there. The air grew colder, wrapping around me like an unwelcome blanket, and the lights flickered intermittently, casting eerie shadows that danced along the walls. I told myself it was nothing, just a late night train rumbling through the darkness, an overactive imagination running wild after too many ghost stories, but then I saw it, a faint drip beneath his seat. Dark. Red. It pooled slowly, a sinister reminder that not everything is as it seems in the stillness of the night, and my heart raced as the weight of dread settled in my chest, urging me to look away, yet somehow compelling me to stay. My stomach twisted with anxiety, an unsettling feeling that crept up as I stood, edging cautiously toward the aisle, when suddenly the train lurched violently, throwing me back into my seat with alarming force. The lights died completely, plunging us into an abyss of darkness, the only source of illumination being the ghostly moonlight that filtered through the fogged windows, casting jagged shadows that danced ominously across the carriage. Clack clack, clack clack. The rhythmic sound of the train's wheels on the tracks echoed in the silence, heightening my tension. I held my breath, straining to peer at the figure of the man across the aisle, his face obscured by shadows. He hadn't flinched, seemingly unfazed by the chaos surrounding us, and that unsettling calm only deepened my unease, making me wonder what secrets he held in the depths of the night. Then, slowly, his head turned. Not his body, just his head, swiveling unnaturally until his pale face locked onto mine with a chilling intensity. His eyes were wide, unblinking, as if frozen in a moment of eternal dread, and his lips parted in a thin, crooked smile that sent a shiver down my spine. The dripping grew louder, a steady pat-pat-pat against the floor, echoing in the sudden silence that filled the air around us. I scrambled for my phone, hands shaking uncontrollably, heart racing as terror washed over me, but the screen wouldn't light despite my frantic jabs. The train sped up, the clacking now a frantic roar that drowned out all rational thought, making it feel like my very sanity was being swept away with each relentless beat. I could feel the weight of his gaze piercing through me, and I could not escape the dreadful realization that I was utterly alone in this speeding metal cage. Next stop, a voice crackled over the intercom, distorted and guttural, is yours. The words hung in the air, echoing through the dimly lit cabin as anticipation coursed through the passengers. Each traveler exchanged glances filled with curiosity and a hint of apprehension, their minds racing with thoughts of where this next destination might lead. The vehicle slowed, the faint rumble of the engine softening to a gentle hum, while outside the window, shadows loomed large, hinting at the unknown waiting just beyond the doors. The man stood, his coat swaying as he stepped into the aisle, the fabric whispering secrets of the night. He didn't walk, he glided, his feet hovering an inch above the floor, as if defying the very laws of gravity. The dripping followed him, a trail of red snaking toward me, pulsating with an unsettling rhythm that echoed the dread building within my chest. I pressed myself against the window, heart hammering like a frantic drum, as he stopped beside my seat, blocking the faint glimmer of streetlights outside. His head tilted, that smile widening until it seemed almost unnatural, stretching across his pale face, revealing an unsettling familiarity. As the air around us thickened with tension, he leaned in closer and whispered, "You shouldn't have looked," sending shivers racing down my spine, a warning laced with something far more sinister. The lights snapped back on, bathing the compartment in a stark, fluorescent glow. He was gone, vanished as if he had been nothing more than a figment of my imagination. The seat ahead was empty, the floor spotless, echoing the absence of life that filled the carriage with an eerie stillness. My heart raced as the train slowed, brakes squealing like a distressed animal as it pulled into a station I didn't recognize, a place that felt foreign and unsettling. The sign outside read, "End of the line." Confusion gnawed at me, my ticket said three more stops were still to come. I grabbed my bag and ran for the door, my breath quickening with each step, but as it slid open with a hesitant creak, I froze. Beyond the platform, there was nothing, just a void, black and endless, swallowing the tracks and suffusing the air with a sense of dread. The silence was oppressive, a heavy blanket weighing down my thoughts, as I stood on the brink of an unknown fate, my mind racing with questions and fears. The doors sealed shut behind me, confining the turmoil I had narrowly escaped. The train surged forward like it was striving to breach the sound barrier, the wheels producing a steady, rhythmic sound that resonated throughout the car. As I settled into my seat, the flickering overhead lights cast an unsettling atmosphere reminiscent of a haunting film. From the dim recesses at the opposite end of the car, I heard it again, a soft pat pat pat, a sound that suggested an imminent threat. I found myself bracing for an unexpected encounter, imagining a figure emerging, perhaps with a sinister intent, to deliver a chilling message. "Your time on Earth is over. Charlie the Squirrel." The sun had just begun to peek over the treetops, casting a golden glow through the leaves of my locust tree home. I twitched my bushy tail, feeling the morning chill that nipped at my fur, and with each flick of my tail, I felt more alive. I leaped from branch to branch with the agility only a squirrel could muster, the thrill of the leap sending a rush of adrenaline through my small frame. Below, the world was waking up, the distant sounds of birds chirping harmonizing with the gentle rustle of the leaves. The rich scent of dew-soaked grass filled the air, invigorating me further, but up here, I was already on the hunt, scanning the ground for acorns or the slightest movement that might signal arrival. As the sunlight intensified, the forest came alive with vibrant colors, and I reveled in the beauty surrounding me, my heart racing with anticipation of what the day might bring. My name is Charlie, and today was like any other day in the grand scheme of things, but to me, every day was an adventure. My mission? To find the most exquisite morsels of food this neighborhood has to offer. Natural morsels or leftovers from humans weren't just food, they were treasure, each one a small victory in the grand game of survival. I scampered down the trunk, my claws digging into the rough bark, my eyes darting around for signs of danger or opportunity. The neighborhood floor was a mosaic of grass, bushes, and shadows, and I knew every crack and crevice where food might hide. There, under the shadow of a bush, I spotted it, a perfect, unblemished morsel. I dashed to it, my heart racing with excitement. But no sooner had I grabbed it than I heard the rustle of leaves behind me. I spun around, a meal clutched in my paws, to see a rival, another squirrel, eyeing my prize. The chase was on. We zipped through the underbrush, over sidewalks, and around trees. I could hear his breath, feel the wind of his tail against mine. We were equals in speed and cunning, but I was driven by the fierce desire to claim that morsel for my winter stash. I darted up a pine tree, knowing its rough bark would be harder for him to climb. I scampered to the top, balancing on the needles, and finally, he gave up, descending back to the ground. I watched him go, my heart pounding with victory, then carefully, I made my way back to my home. With my prize secured in my cheek, I looked out over the neighborhood. The sun was higher now, the day warming up. Below, humans walked their paths, unaware of the dramas unfolding above them. But up here, in the squirrel world, every morsel was a story, every chase a chapter in the endless book of life. I tucked my morsel away in my secret cache, hidden among the branches. Then, with a flick of my tail, I was off again, because in the life of a squirrel, there's no time to rest, there's always another meal to find, another adventure to live. Us squirrels must also be on the lookout for the not-so-friendly animals that want to make us a healthy meal for them. Almost every day I see the local fox travel through the neighborhood looking for a fresh meal. Sometimes I see an occasional coyote and once a possum journeyed through. I am old enough to remember when the neighborhood was loaded with rabbits. Those carnivorous animals have made many meals out of the rabbit population. I am lucky, I can climb trees and evade them where rabbits do not have that luxury. And so, the hunt continues until the sun sets and the moon rises to watch over us all. The day of Get a Life, Jared. Today, February 13, 2025, is just another Thursday, one of those days that slips by unnoticed, like water through your fingers. Here's a recount of how Jared, Get a Life unfolded, or rather, didn't. Morning, the alarm sounded at its usual time, 7 a.m., but there was no rush, no excitement to jump out of bed. The sky outside was a uniform gray, not dark enough for drama, nor light enough for optimism. Breakfast was the same as yesterday, oatmeal with a sprinkle of cinnamon because even on a day like this, variety seemed too much effort. The news on the radio was the usual, political debates, local weather, and a sports score from a game I didn't watch. Work, I logged into work at 9 a.m. sharp. The digital clock on my computer was the highlight of my morning, ticking away the seconds with an almost mocking steadiness. Emails trickled in, none urgent, none interesting. Most were updates on projects that haven't moved in weeks. The meeting at 10:30 was rescheduled for no particular reason, which, in corporate speak, means we have nothing to discuss. My fingers danced over the keyboard, writing reports that felt like deja vu, a repetition of last week's work. Lunch break, lunch was a sandwich from the same old deli. The bread was slightly too soft, the lettuce a bit too limp, but complaining felt unnecessary. I ate while scrolling through social media, the same posts, the same memes, the same debates. It was as if the world outside my window was on pause, stuck in a loop of yesterday's news. Afternoon, back at work, the afternoon dragged. The office was quiet, the hum of the air conditioner providing a monotonous backdrop to the day. I tried to start a new project, but motivation was as absent as the sun. Instead, I spent an inordinate amount of time organizing my digital files, something I've been putting off for months, not because it needed doing, but because there was nothing else to do. Evening, the clock struck 5 p.m., and I was out the door, not with a sense of liberation, but with the knowledge that tomorrow would likely be a rerun of today. Dinner was something out of the freezer, heated in the microwave. The TV offered the usual fare of reality shows and sitcoms I've seen countless times. The highlight of the evening was choosing between watching paint dry or my neighbor's cat, who at least had the decency to look bored in an interesting way. Reflection, as I sit here writing this, I realize that today was not marked by events or achievements, but by its profound ordinariness. There's a certain peace in the lack of chaos, but there's also a whisper of melancholy. In the quiet, one can hear the ticks of life passing, a reminder that even the most unremarkable days are part of our time here. Today was not about what happened, but what didn't. And in that absence, there's a story too, one of waiting, of patience, or perhaps just of accepting that not every day needs to be memorable to be lived. So, here's to the boring days, the ones that give us time to breathe, to think, or maybe just to exist. Tomorrow is Valentine's Day, who knows, I may meet the love of my life somewhere between my boring breakfast to the time I go to bed. Yes, I can still dream and think of the future. If it wasn't for the vivid dreams I have, I would really be bored. From the snowman's perspective. In the deep silence of a frosty winter night, I awakened to the sensation of being. My first memory was of the cold, the crisp, biting chill that somehow felt like home. I was a snowman, crafted with care and love, standing in the heart of a quaint little garden that sparkled under the moonlight. From my vantage point, I could see the world in a way few others could. My eyes, two shiny black buttons, caught the gleam of stars and the distant lights from the houses. My carrot nose pointed toward the sky, snuffling in the icy air, while my mouth, a crooked line of pebbles, seemed to smile despite the cold. The first morning was magical. The sun rose, casting a golden glow across the landscape, turning the frost into a million tiny prisms. Children, bundled in their colorful winter gear, rushed out to greet me. Their laughter was like music, their shouts of joy as they circled me, a symphony of delight. I felt a deep sense of pride, knowing I was the centerpiece of their winter wonderland. Days passed, each with its own rhythm and beauty. The children would come daily, sometimes adding more to my form, a scarf here, a hat there, making me feel even more part of their world. They'd talk to me, share secrets, and even tell stories, as if I were an old friend. I listened, or rather, I absorbed their words, their warmth. But with joy came the understanding of my ephemeral nature. I watched as the sun climbed higher each day, its warmth beginning to nibble at my edges. My arms, once sturdy branches, started to droop, and my body slowly lost its crisp outline. Snowflakes that once made me would melt, seeping into the ground, returning to the cycle from which they came. The children noticed too. Their faces grew solemn as they realized what was happening. They tried to rebuild me with fresh snow, but it was like fighting the inevitable march of time. One evening, as the sun set, painting the sky in hues of pink and orange, they gathered around me for what I knew would be the last time. They spoke of next winter, of another snowman, but their voices were tinged with sorrow. I felt a pang, not of fear, for I knew I was but a part of the season, but of love for these fleeting moments we shared. As night fell, I felt my form softening, my vision blurring until the world was nothing but a soft, white blur. In those final moments, I reflected on the beauty of existing, even if only for a brief while. I was a guardian of their winter memories, a friend who stood tall in the cold, a symbol of joy in the heart of winter. And then, with the quiet dignity of winter's end, I returned to the earth, my essence mingling with the ground, waiting, perhaps, for another winter to come when I might rise again, to laugh with the children, to stand once more under the vast, starry sky. McGregor the Winter Jacket. Hello, I am McGregor, I was made in the early summer with thousands of brothers. I am a unique winter jacket. I have a nylon lining and fleece insert. Inside the curled collar is a hidden nylon hood the wearer can wear and then fold and put back in the collar when inclement weather is over. The outside of the jacket is a dark green color that looks like a short curly furry coat. However, it is made of nylon, not animal fur. I am 100% washable. I was made in a plant in Atlanta, Georgia. I am proud to wear the label, made in the USA. Now my brothers cannot wear this label. In the fall of that year, the owners of the plant moved the plant and equipment to Taiwan. I heard it was because of the high cost of labor. The owners sent a proposal to the union and the union rejected the offer. After that, the plant was closed and all the equipment was moved to Taiwan. It was a shame all the workers had to find new careers after that move. Back to my story, I laid around in the factory until the end of August. At that time, me and four brothers, size 36, size 40, size 42, and size 44 were packed into a box and was shipped to the JCPenney store in the Villa Italia shopping center in Lakewood. They unpacked us and put us on hangers and hung us on a large rack with hundreds of jackets from different plants and many features unique to them. I am just amazed at the number of different choices the American shopper has. I was tried on many times by many different people. Every time I was put back on the rack. Three of my brothers were sold. Size 36 and I were the only ones left. Then around the first part of November, JCPenney's really hurt me. They put on the rack of coats a sign stating, half off of shown price. This devastated me. This means my value went from $39.95 to less than $20, how humiliating, and I am worth more than this. I was hanging on the rack for a couple of weeks and then this tall slim young man came up and looks at my brother, size 36. He tries on size 36 and then hangs him up back on the rack. He then tries on me. He looks in the mirror, turns around and looks at the back. He tries my zipper and removes the hood from my collar. No one has ever spent this much time checking me out. To my surprise, I am taken over to the cashier. Is this young man going to purchase me? Sure enough, he takes out his credit card and buys me. I see from his credit card that his name is Tom. I now have a new owner. The next 3 years were good. In the winter I went many places. I was worn all during the winter and I kept Tom very warm. During the summer I was placed way back in the closet to rest. When it started to cool off in the fall I was pulled back out of the back of the closet and put into service and kept Tom warm when he was outside. Unfortunately, this only lasted 3 years. On the fourth year I spent the winter stuck back in the back of the closet. The fifth winter and the sixth winter were the same. This is beginning to feel like solitary confinement. Did Tom replace me with another jacket? I was snoozing near the end of May, and I heard some rustling. Tom brought me out of the back of the closet. Wow. That sun is really bright. What is going on? The temperature is pretty warm. Why did Tom bring me out this time of year? I was thrown in the trunk of the car with some funny-looking equipment, and some of it really had a strange odor. After a couple of hours, Tom opened the trunk and took out the equipment with me. I have become a part of Tom's fishing gear. There are many fishing memories I have acquired. For example, I remember when Tom was fishing on the Colorado River, and it was drizzling a little. When Tom fished the Colorado River, he would use some kind of bug he would get from under river rocks. Tom was fishing this rolling piece of the river and wham, this fish struck his bait. Tom set the hook, and the fish jumped out of the water. Wow! That fish must have been over 10 pounds. Tom was really getting excited. I could feel his heart pounding on my lining. Tom was fighting the fish and being very careful reeling in that gigantic fish. All of a sudden, the fish line became loose. The fish was lost. What happened? Tom reeled in the line and discovered the hook was missing and half of the leader was missing. Speculation is that the nylon fishing line should be replaced every year and the line just broke because the line was a couple of years old. This was a lesson learned the hard way. Another great memory happened when Tom was at a lake near Laramie, Wyoming. There was a cool breeze blowing off of the lake. This was a lake where only flies and artificial lures were allowed. Tom had a woolly worm fly on his line. He cast out the fly and wham! This large rainbow struck that woolly worm fly. The rainbow trout jumped a couple of times, and it looked gigantic. After 10 minutes of battle, Tom was able to get this fish in his net. This fish weighed over 5 pounds, what a prize! Jack, Tom's fishing buddy, came over to see what kind of lure Tom was using and saw that funny-looking woolly worm fly and commented, could he use the other sleeve of Tom's coat? I must admit that the fly did look very similar to my sleeve, only smaller. Tom made the comment that this was the largest fish he had ever caught. The next couple of summer months were great. Tom took me fishing many times during the summer and on occasion we went ice fishing during the winter. I could not stay in the closet anymore because I was dirty and smelled like salmon eggs. Now, I had to stay in the garage with his fishing gear. The garage just was not as comfortable as that warm closet. Then Tom met this woman. His interest in fishing suddenly diminished. He began spending more and more time with this woman. Hormones finally won. Tom got married and fathered 2 sons in the next 3 years. Family life became very important to Tom. Another factor was the Arab oil embargo. The high costs of fuel made Tom think twice before he invested in a fishing trip. Jack, Tom's fishing buddy, became very sick and passed on after a long illness. All of these events made fishing lose its appeal. I spent many years hanging in the garage and the only exciting thing happened was when a moth flew around looking for a meal to eat. Many landed on me and then realized I was nylon and polyester, not cotton. The moths did not find my fabric very tasty. It may have been the fishy smell too. One day Tom took me off the hook, threw me in the washing machine with some soap and washed me. He could have used some warm water. That cold wash cycle sure was uncomfortable. He could have dried me in the dryer. No, he hung me on a hanger, and I had to drip dry in the cold breeze. Before I know it, I was thrown in a large box with hundreds of other coats. I was part of a winter coat drive the church had for the homeless and poor. This homeless man reached in the box and grabbed me. He didn't care what I looked like or even if I fit. I never knew his name. He lived under a bridge on the banks of the Platte River. He was more interested in that spirit in the bottle that he always carried with him. Many times, he left me lying on the banks of the Platte River. If he remembered where I was, he would pick me up and wear me for a while. He sure did stink. I would take the smell of salmon eggs any day. One day I was lying on the bank close to the river. There was a storm upstream and the river started to rise from the runoff. The river started to get closer and closer. I started to get wet and finally the current of the river grabbed me. I started to float down the river. It was a struggle to stay afloat. I was beginning to really get soaked. I finally had to succumb to the weight of my wetness and sank to the floor of the river. I was rolling along the bottom of the river, and I became snagged in a submerged tree branch. I was never seen again. An assignment for a night. Here I am hovering over my assignment for the night of October 31, 2024. My assignment was to make sure Tom makes it through the night. Sometimes I wonder, how are these assignments passed out? What spirit is assigned to who and why? Or is it just a random drawing? This is something that will never be revealed to the spirit army. From my orders I see that Tom is a male over 80 years old. He was in his mother's womb when Japan bombed Pearl Harbor on December 7, 1941. Tom is living a typical American life. He was never famous or well known. Just one of the millions who try to do best with what they must encounter in their life. Tom was drafted into the Army in 1964. He was very fortunate he did not have to experience the pain of war. He was assigned to Germany and the other seven he was drafted with went to Vietnam. Tom always wonders why that happened and thought about that throughout his life. Why was he so fortunate? Tom did have some difficult times in his life though. Tom had to experience the hurt and pain of a divorce. Over 5 years of unemployment was hard and very stressful. However, all in all, he has been very blessed during his 80 years on this earth. As I started my assignment, I noticed that Tom fell asleep very fast. No tossing and turning for Tom. Lights out, nighty night. His nights are full of dreams. He almost started dreaming immediately. Being a spirit, I have the benefit of hearing and seeing subconscious and conscious activity. Can't hide anything from me. His first dream was about Sandra. She was his first female attraction. They went through school together, from kindergarten through high school. Because of religious conflicts, Tom started pulling away, and after high school, they went their separate ways and lost all contact. 50 years later, Tom had a dream. Sandra came to her and said, "Tom, we were meant for each other. Our lives would have been totally different than what has been." This woke Tom up with a start, and finally, after a week, Tom decided to research the internet looking for some information. He had to go to high school alumni newsletters to acquire her married name, and doing the search, he discovered that Sandra died 3 days before he experienced the eye-opening dream. Wow. This convinced Tom that spirits and living do have on occasions contact between them. Since that experience, Tom is convinced there is time after life on Earth. Now the time is around 1 o'clock in the morning. That 80-year-old bladder says it is time for attention. After a couple of minutes of attending to bodily functions, Tom returns to bed and immediately falls back to sleep. The next dream is about Vietnam. Wait a minute, Tom was never in Vietnam. This dream was through the eyes of a sergeant, and they were in a firefight with the Viet Cong. A troop crawls over to him and says, "Sarge, we can't return fire because the Viet Cong is using civilians as shields, what should we do? They are slowly killing or wounding us." After some tortuous thoughts, the sergeant commands shoot them and kill those bastards hiding behind the human shields. Was this Tom, or do we live parallel lives and that was a parallel life speaking and somehow the signals were sent to the wrong parallel life? The dream was through the eyes. I never saw what face I had. Mine or someone else's. The name Sarge was used, not Tom. One will never know who it was. 3 o'clock in the morning and the bladder is demanding some attention. Tom does what is demanded by his bladder, but this time he does not go back to sleep. Coming back to bed, he begins to toss and turn. He finally starts thinking about his latest project of creating video podcasts. Just before bed, Tom was working on combining sound with photos or clip art and didn't figure it out before bedtime, so now some time had to be spent thinking about this obstacle. Tomorrow he will see if his options work out. Finally, he falls back to sleep and dreams about his near-death experience in February 2023. Tom experienced something unusual during that time. In his own thoughts, he thought he took his last breath and went somewhere. He likes to say that he was in the waiting room waiting to go to time after death or return to life on Earth. During that time, he experienced something out of this world. That was peace, total peace. A feeling he has never felt in his life before and has not felt since. Then the surgeons removed the blood clot and Tom returned to life on Earth. Tom had a large blood clot between the lungs and the survival rate was 3-5%. Tom was one of the survivors. This dream was an attempt to experience that great feeling he had. Sorry, it did not work. Bladder calls again and then back to dreams. This was a Halloween dream since it was Halloween yesterday. It was a scary dream. Tom and his wife were in an old-fashioned streetcar, and someone came on and did something bad. The men on the streetcar started fighting with him and savaged him, tearing him up and mutilating him. He ended up with this gelatin-like substance you see in jars of pickled pig's feet. This nightmare was so bad it woke him up with a start. At that time, it was 7:30 in the morning and time to take his blood thinner medication and start another day. In summary, this was an interesting assignment. It was more interesting than I anticipated. Tom has led an interesting and full life. Tom is over 80 and knows that he is near time after life. It may be 10 days from now or 10 years. He has lost his fear of death from experiences in his life, especially his near-death event. Now I must go to my next day assignment. Spirits do not sleep. We do not need sleep. The Wicked Whispers of Willow Creek. In the heart of a dense, ancient forest, lay the quiet town of Willow Creek. By day, it was a picturesque place with cobblestone streets and charming cottages. But when the sun dipped below the horizon, the town's character changed. Legend had it that the woods surrounding Willow Creek were home to the Wicked Whispers, eerie voices that echoed through the trees, leading lost souls deeper into the forest. Some said they were the spirits of those who had perished in the woods long ago, while others believed they were the enchantments of a powerful sorceress. Among the townsfolk was young Ilara, an adventurous girl with a curious mind. She had grown up hearing tales of the Wicked Whispers but had never experienced them herself. One moonlit night, driven by her insatiable curiosity, Ilara decided to venture into the forest, determined to uncover the truth. As she walked deeper into the woods, the familiar sounds of the town faded away, replaced by an unsettling silence. Then, she heard it, a soft, melodious whisper that seemed to call her name. Ilara. Ilara. The voice was both enchanting and chilling. Ilara followed the whisper, her heart pounding with a mix of fear and excitement. The path grew narrower, and the trees seemed to close in around her. The whisper grew louder, more insistent. Ilara, come closer. She stumbled upon a clearing bathed in the pale light of the full moon. At its center stood an ancient, gnarled tree, its twisted branches reaching out like the arms of a ghost. The whispers now came from all directions, encircling her. With a deep breath, Ilara stepped forward and placed her hand on the tree's trunk. Instantly, the whispers ceased, and a figure materialized before her, a woman with eyes like sapphires and hair as dark as the night. I am Seraphina, the guardian of these woods, the figure spoke, her voice as enchanting as the whispers. The Wicked Whispers are a test, a trial for those who seek the truth. Ilara listened in awe as Seraphina revealed the forest's secrets, its history, and the magic that flowed through its roots. She learned that the whispers were not malevolent but a challenge to those brave enough to seek their source. With newfound understanding, Ilara returned to Willow Creek, her heart filled with the wisdom of the forest. She shared her story with the townsfolk, who listened with rapt attention. From that day forward, the Wicked Whispers were no longer feared but respected, a reminder of the mysteries that lay just beyond the edge of town. And so, the legend of the Wicked Whispers of Willow Creek lived on, a tale of courage, curiosity, and the magic that lies hidden in the heart of the woods. Time after life. Ah, peace, that elusive butterfly in the human garden of emotions. What brings peace to one might be the very thing that stirs another's existential anxiety. Peace, it seems, is as personal as it is universal. Many find peace within themselves. Peace is not just the absence of conflict, it's the presence of inner calm. Peace often comes from feeling connected, whether through family, friends, or a community. Others turn to the natural world that soothes the human spirit. A walk in the forest, the sound of waves. For some, peace comes from aligning with a set of beliefs that promise a higher purpose or afterlife. One engaging in acts of kindness can bring peace for others. Engaging in or experiencing art can be deeply peaceful. Some find peace in understanding the world through technology or the vastness of knowledge available today. Others find peace in writing, the explosion of blogging proves that. I can experience peace from the above items. However, about a year and a half ago, I had a near-death experience. I was laying on the operating table and a medical assistant said, "Doctor, his blood pressure is dropping fast." I was feeling very bad, and I thought I just took my last breath. I do not know where I went, but I felt a peace I have never felt in all my life. Peace, total peace. I cannot explain it, but the feeling was great. I believe I had a preview of time after death. When I came back, that feeling of peace, total peace, disappeared, and I have not felt it since. In conclusion, I believe that I will not experience that feeling until the time after life. Tales of a former smoker. Colorado in 2008 was having a debate to outlaw smoking in public establishments. Casinos say that the smoking ban will more than likely affect their business. Approximately 20% of Colorado residents are smokers. Bar owners ask appeals court to overturn the state smoking ban. These are all headings of stories about the statewide smoking ban. Smoking is still an issue. The major majority voted for a smoking ban in recent years. There are still 20% who feel they are being unfairly treated with the smoking bans. I have been on both sides of the issue. I was a smoker and quit many years before any smoking ban took effect. I started smoking when I was in the 8th grade. Why did I start? I would say because of peer pressure. Everyone I ran around with started smoking about the same time. It was cool. Many movie stars smoked. You would go to a movie and smoking was always featured. Fred Flintstone and Barney smoked in advertised Winston cigarettes. Smoking was the thing to do if you wanted to be cool. My dad smoked. The local parish priest smoked. Many neighbors smoked. This was all before the adverse effects of smoking were known. No one cared about the addictive effects of nicotine, or the tar buildup in your lungs. I remember when I first started smoking. You would inhale and suddenly become dizzy. I never did get sick to my stomach though. After a period, the dizziness went away and the addiction to nicotine took over. You were hooked. I smoked through high school and beyond. I was drafted into the army in 1964 and at those times most of the new recruits smoked. I recall the saying, "Smoke them if you have them." A cloud of smoke would rise from the company of troops where only a half a dozen or so did not smoke. The red butkin with an inch of water in the kin lined the center of the barracks. Sometimes I think cigarettes were more important than bullets. I was still smoking when I got out of the army and continued to smoke for a few more years. At that time there were no regulations about smoking. I would smoke 1 to 2 packs a day. That was when a pack was around 25 cents. I smoked everywhere. I would smoke in the grocery store checkout line. I smoked in the house and the car, throwing out the butts through the window. I was a rude, ruthless smoker. I didn't care about anybody's rights. I stunk from cigarette smoke and my fingers would turn yellow from the tobacco burning cigarette. Nicotine really had me hooked. Here I was 25 and I would huff and puff going up a flight of stairs. The effects of smoking were becoming known, and I was beginning to experience the effects. I began to realize smoking was affecting my health. I decided that I wanted to live a long healthy life and continuing to smoke was going to hamper this desire. I decided to quit. For the next 2 to 3 years, I must have quit 200 times or more. I finally succeeded. I no longer am addicted to nicotine. It took me about a year before I did not have that nicotine urge. 2 more years passed before the smell of smoke ceased to smell good and I wanted to have just one cigarette. I knew if I had one, I would be hooked again. I was 28 when I finally succeeded in quitting. Stopping smoking was the hardest thing I ever did in my life. Where am I now? It has been over 50 years since I finally quit smoking. I speculate that if I did not quit smoking, I would be dead from heart disease or lung cancer. In the late 70s, my father was having circulation problems in his right leg and his primary doctor referred him to a specialist. The first question the specialist asked my father was, "How long did you smoke?" We asked why he asked that, and he responded by telling us that circulation problems in the legs are characteristic of smokers. Well, the specialist was not able to save my father's leg and the last 5 years of his life was without his right leg. My father was 70 when this happened. I was 45 and I am hoping I am not going to continue the legacy of my father. I see people my age that are dependent on their oxygen tank. Seeing these people makes me very thankful that I can still breathe on my own. Maybe I quit soon enough in my life to bypass these bullets. After reading this you may think, he is really anti-smoking, he wants stronger no smoking laws. I don't really agree with the current smoking laws. In my opinion I feel that smoking or no smoking should be up to the individual business owner. If a business owner wants to cater to the 20% of the smoking population, they become a smoking establishment. If they want to do business with the 80% of the non-smoking population, you become a no-smoking establishment. Businesses are either smoking or no smoking, no combination establishments would be allowed. As a consumer I can elect to go to the establishment I want to. Let the market forces determine whom you want to do business with. In conclusion, I made a big mistake when I smoked that first cigarette. You become addicted to nicotine faster than you imagine. There is no easy way to quit once you become addicted. If you are young and consider smoking that cigarette, think twice and say no, it may save you a lot of pain and suffering. No, I did not follow my father's legacy of passing away at 75. I am now over 80 and still very thankful that I was successful in quitting smoking when I was 28. About 2 years ago, my son, who was 46 years old at that time, had a life-threatening heart attack to realize that smoking can shorten your life. He has not had a cigarette since that life-threatening event. Too cute to not pass it on. A cowboy named Bud was overseeing his herd in a remote mountainous pasture in Montana when suddenly a brand new BMW advanced toward him out of a cloud of dust. The driver, a young man in a Brioni-registered suit, Gucci-registered shoes, Ray-Ban-registered sunglasses and YSL-registered tie, leaned out the window and asked the cowboy, "If I tell you exactly how many cows and calves you have in your herd, will you give me a calf?" Bud looks at the man, who obviously is a yuppie, then looks at his peacefully grazing herd and calmly answers, "Sure, why not?" The yuppie parks his car, whips out his Dell-registered notebook computer, connects it to his singular RAZR-V3-registered cell phone, and surfs to a NASA page on the internet, where he calls up a GPS satellite to get an exact fix on his location, which he then feeds to another NASA satellite that scans the area in an ultra-high-resolution photo. The young man then opens the digital photo in Adobe Photoshop registered and exports it to an image processing facility in Hamburg, Germany. Within seconds, he receives an email on his Palm Pilot registered that the image has been processed and the data stored. He then accesses an MS SQL registered database through an ODBC connected Excel registered spreadsheet with email on his BlackBerry registered and, after a few minutes, receives a response. Finally, he prints out a full color, 150-page report on his high-tech, miniaturized HP LaserJet registered printer, turns to the cowboy and says, "You have exactly 1,586 cows and calves." "That's right. Well, I guess you can take one of my calves," says Bud. He watches the young man select one of the animals and looks on with amusement as the young man stuffs it into the trunk of his car. Then Bud says to the young man, "Hey, if I can tell you exactly what your business is, will you give me back my calf?" The young man thinks about it for a second and then says, "Okay, why not? You're a congressman for the US government," says Bud. "Wow. That's correct," says the yuppie, "but how did you guess that?" "No guessing required," answered the cowboy. "You showed up here even though nobody called you. You want to get paid for an answer I already knew, to a question I never asked. You used millions of dollars worth of equipment trying to show me how much smarter than me you are, and you don't know a thing about how working people make a living, or about cows, for that matter. This is a herd of sheep. Now give me back my dog." The Stairway in a Dream. Tom was exhausted, his days tangled in the grind of hospital shifts and the quiet ache of loneliness since his grandmother passed. Each shift felt like an eternity, filled with the rhythmic sounds of medical machinery and the soft murmur of conversations that seldom reached his heart. One night, after collapsing into bed, he slipped into a dream unlike any he'd had before. In this vivid realm, colors danced around him, and comforting voices echoed, bringing with them the warmth he had longed for amidst the cold sterility of his waking life. As he wandered through this enchanting landscape, he felt a glimmer of hope, as though the essence of his grandmother was guiding her toward healing and connection. He stood in a field, golden grass swaying under a sky that shimmered like stained glass, hues of blue and violet dancing together in a serene harmony. Ahead, a stairway spiraled upward, its steps carved from light, pulsing softly like the heartbeat of the world around him. Tom felt no fear, only a pull, like a melody calling him forward, a tune that resonated deeply within his soul, filling him with an inexplicable warmth. Each step he took felt deliberate, as if the very air whispered secrets of the universe, guiding his ascent into the unknown. He began to climb, his heart racing with anticipation, eager to uncover what awaited him at the top of this ethereal staircase. Each step hummed with warmth, and as he ascended, memories flickered around him like fireflies in the dusk, his grandmother's laughter as they baked bread, the sweet aroma of yeast rising in the air, his own childhood voice singing off-key to the tunes of faded melodies, moments of kindness he'd forgotten, like small treasures hidden in the corners of his heart. The higher he climbed, the lighter he felt, as if the weight of his regrets snapped words, missed chances, and the lingering guilt of unanswered apologies dissolved into the glowing air, replaced by an overwhelming sense of acceptance and serenity. With each ascent, he embraced the warmth of those cherished recollections, allowing them to envelop him, illuminating the path ahead with a radiant glow that filled him with hope and renewed purpose. At the top, the stairs opened to a vast garden, blooming with colors he couldn't name, each flower adding its unique hue to the tapestry of nature. Figures moved among the flowers, their faces familiar yet radiant. His grandmother, younger than Tom remembered, her eyes bright and sparkling like stars in the evening sky. The air was thick with the sweet fragrance of blossoms, and the gentle hum of bees flitting from petal to petal created a serene melody. "You're not staying yet," his grandmother said, her voice a warm embrace that wrapped around Tom like a soft blanket on a chilly day. "But see how loved you are, surrounded by the beauty of your memories, waiting for you to return and cherish them once more." Others appeared, patients Tom had comforted, friends she'd lost touch with, even strangers she'd smiled at in passing. They didn't speak, but their presence wove a quiet truth. Every small act of her had rippled through the tapestry of life, touching lives she'd never traced or even considered. Each smile exchanged on a crowded street, every word of encouragement spoken in the hushed tones of a hospital room, had forged unseen connections that now filled the air around his. In this moment, Tom realized the profound impact of kindness, the way it spread like a warm breeze, gently nudging hearts toward hope and understanding. Tom's chest ached with joy, not pain, as she embraced this realization, feeling an overwhelming sense of gratitude for the unseen threads that intertwined his with those who had crossed his path. His grandmother took his hand, leading him to a pool of light that shimmered like a thousand stars brought to life. In its reflection, Tom saw himself not the tired nurse who often felt overwhelmed by the weight of his responsibilities, but a woman woven from courage and care, radiating strength and grace. The warmth of the light washed over him, illuminating the dreams he had long forgotten and the aspirations that still flickered within his heart. "You're still needed below," his grandmother whispered gently, his voice echoing with the wisdom of ages. "But you'll carry this now, this newfound sense of purpose and love, as you return. Let it guide you whenever the path seems dark, for you are never alone in your journey." Tom woke with tears on his cheeks, the hospital's sterile hum distant, a haunting reminder of his fragile reality. The dream's glow lingered in his bones, a certainty that heaven wasn't just a place but a truth, his life mattered, and he wasn't alone in this vast universe full of connection and love. The comforting warmth of that revelation wrapped around him like a soft blanket, easing the tightness in his chest. He took a deep breath, filling his lungs with the scent of antiseptic air, and rose from the sheets, lighter than before, ready to face the day with renewed hope and determination, knowing that each moment was a gift waiting to be embraced. In closing, as you turn this final page, I want to pause and thank you for joining me on this journey through the winding paths of story and memory. The tales and experiences woven into these pages, some spun from the threads of imagination, others carved from the raw edges of life, were crafted with the hope of touching something universal, something deeply human. Each story, whether it whispered of joy, trembled with loss, or sparkled with the absurd, was an invitation to sit with the fleeting moments that shape who we are. Writing this collection has been a labor of love, a process of sifting through the chaos of existence to find meaning in the small and the strange. Some of these pieces came to me in bursts, like lightning striking a quiet field, others grew slowly, like roots pushing through stubborn earth. Together, they form a mosaic not perfect, but honest. I've always believed that stories are mirrors and windows all at once. They show us parts of ourselves we might have forgotten, and they open vistas to lives we might never live. My greatest wish is that somewhere in these pages, you found a reflection you recognized or a view that surprised you. The beauty of short fiction lies in its brevity, its ability to capture a single breath of life and hold it up to the light. Yet, even in their smallness, these stories carry weight. They remind us that every moment, every choice, every fleeting encounter has the power to ripple outward, shaping not just our own paths but the world around us. The experiences shared here, whether real or conjured, are my attempt to honor that truth, to celebrate the messy, marvelous complexity of being alive. Thank you for trusting me with your time and your heart. Until our paths cross again, may you find wonder in the ordinary and courage in the unknown.